Is this working?
Damn it!
Why can I not hear my... Well, I can sort of hear myself. Oh, that's why. I just blew everybody out the back of their apartment in their house right now. So we got Aaron and Paul. Paul and Aaron right here. Let's do the... Oh, did you guys hear my new intro where I added something at the beginning? Okay. My sister-in-law and her boyfriend listened to old radio, and they found this old Lone Ranger where the villain's name is Greg. It's not like Black Bart or, you know, anything like that. His just name's just Greg.
Hey, who? What? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
It's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Well, you'll just assume that the recording window's working. I know my digital recorder's working. Let's plug in here so we can hear Paul and Aaron here. Just a sec.
Low tech, as always.
That should be your rap name, low tech.
Yo-Yo Low Tech.
I like that, too. You've given yourself a first name. That's nice, Yo-Yo.
Yeah, well, actually, my rap name was given to me years ago. Somebody called me Tenacious G, because we were at a conference, and I walked up to Jacques Vallée and started talking to him. And the people I was with said, "How can you do that?" And I said, "Because I might never get to see him again. That's how I can do that." So that's right.
I still go by the rap nickname that Mac Tonys gave me, Hetero Cool. that's Cool, K-U-L. So.
Yeah, that's exceedingly Teutonic or something.
Beats the name I gave him, which was C Rap Y. So
now, I tried to insist that everybody called me G Money back in college, but it didn't take. So
well, I hope you don't insist on that now, because you'd probably, you know, lose your job or something.
You know, I try to be circumspect.
Yo, G Money, good to talk to you again. I'm definitely gonna roll with that from now on. You're G Money.
Hey, Paul, when I was just about to leave, and Sigrid's packing to be gone for a couple of weeks here, and she said, "I don't know if I like the sound of this show." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Who's the moron? Who are you going to call a bad name?" I said, I don't know. I mean, it's changed twice now. Everybody knows who Paul Kimball is, who's listening to this show. If you don't, go look it up. Aaron, you should know, because I think you've been on twice, right, Aaron?
Yeah, I think this is my third time, I think.
Uh-oh. Now we're going to have to put you on the wall up here of people that have been on more than twice. Aaron is a college professor, yes? And he's written two books, well, two that are out now. Right. One of them is Extraterrestrials and I think the American Zeitgeist. And what was the other one?
The Chaos Conundrum, essays on atemporality and non-rationality.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, and we talked about that last time you were on. However, this time, every year Paul puts out the Zorgi Awards, and Paul, maybe you better explain what that is.
Well, I used to do them every year when I was blogging my Other Side of Truth blog a lot more often, sort of between, I think, 2006 and 2010. I think 2011 was the last year I did them. And I used to have votes. I used to run votes amongst my readership, and I put up a bunch of nominees, and they would vote in different categories. And it's named after the alien explorer. He was Rear Admiral Zorgrot when he arrived on Earth. He's now a full admiral. And he looks suspiciously like a stuffed duck that you could buy in any department store. But in fact, he is an alien explorer. And he's taken a great interest over the years in the UFO subculture, the paranormal subculture. And it's part of his mission to sort of survey this planet and the people that live on it. So every year in the past, he and I used to run these awards. They've sort of been in abeyance for 3 years, but he and I had a conversation over Christmas and we decided we should bring them back. And Greg has kindly provided us the platform
forum,
by which we can announce the winners. And then we can discuss our choices because I'm sure you two, you may agree, or you may not agree. And folks
our
can call
meaning,
in.
Our meaning you and Zorgrot, Admiral Zorgrot.
Exactly. Admiral Zorgrot, who has his own, you know, he has his own Facebook page and everything. So he's his own person. He's not actually here tonight. He's in Ottawa, Canada. He really is conferring with the Prime Minister. That part might or might not be true, but he is actually in Ottawa, the nation's capital. So he can't be here tonight, but he's given me full authority to announce the winners. Most of them are winners. They're very positive this year. There's only one negative award. So.
I was surprised by that. Ahead. I was kind of thinking there'd be more, you know, more snark and cynicism involved, but it's all very uplifting.
Did you hear?
I'm trying to end. Okay, you're on a positive note.
Yeah, I was on, and I don't know who's going to care or take offense to this, but I was on what I said on Don Ecker's show on Dark Matters Radio last week on Friday, and they said, "So what's going on? What are you thinking about? What are you up to?" And I said, "It seems like most of the noise in ufology now is everybody trying to be, at least that I see, is everybody being Jim Moseley." Nobody really cares about the actual phenomenon anymore, as Moseley said, because you can't really do anything with it, although we will talk about that today. But most people seem more concerned about who's fighting. So it's that hasn't changed in a few years. However, to start off on a positive note, do you want to do them in the order that you sent them to us here, Paul? Like the first one is I think it's a blog.
Sure. Well, I can do them, you know, in the order in which you read them out.
Okay.
I have a different order.
I will go in the order that you sent them. The best paranormal and website blog is the first one. Hey, is that picture in Santa Barbara? Is that where Zorgi was? Zorgrot?
In Santa Barbara.
Yeah, that looks like a picture from the mountains above Santa Barbara. Is that what it is, or is it Topanga or something?
Oh, no, that's actually outside Jerome, Arizona.
It's really? It looks like the ocean out there for some reason.
No, no, that's in, I guess, Jerome's in sort of northwestern Arizona. It's a lovely little town.
I know where it is.
That was taken in 2007 when Chris McBride and I were traveling. So there's a UFO connection. We were vacationing in the Southwest, and she was the narrator of my film Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings. And it was the first time I was ever in Los Angeles to stay with you and Sigrid. It was when Chris and I came out as part of our trip. And I had just come from the X Conference in Washington, D.C., where we screened. It's the only time I've ever been to an X Con. So all sorts of UFO synchronicities there.
And it's the last time you'll be...
That's a pretty safe bet, unless I buy a ticket. Well, there are no X conferences anymore, so
that's
there you
true.
Go.
That's
now,
true.
Now they have citizens' hearings on disclosure or whatever it is.
Yeah, some citizens. Okay, keep off wall, and he's sitting on the wall. But the best. This is the picture of Zorgrot that he has sent sent to Aaron and I. I guess these will go up on Other Side of Truth after the show, right? Or sometime after the show.
Yeah, I'll post them on the Radio Mysterioso Facebook page and all those social media things. And some people in the past, when they get these, their JPEGs, you know, sort of with Zorgrot saying, you have won this award, some people actually have taken it seriously.
And so
they display them
site.
On their websites. Yeah. Which, if folks want to do that, that's perfectly awesome. I wouldn't display it on your website if you haven't won, because that would seem a little dishonest. But
we know that doesn't happen.
In keeping with the spirit of the awards, maybe that's perfectly valid. Just take, you know, somebody else's name off and put your name on, and that's fine.
Yeah, it really, like, really messy, too. Like a really obvious job.
Exactly.
2014 Zorgi Award winner, Best Paranormal Website / Blog, The UFO Trail by Jack Brewer.
Ta-da!
Yes.
Yay.
I'd never seen that, and I looked at it today, and it looked like it was saying stuff that I would say anyway, so I instantly liked it.
He doesn't post very often. A lot of blog posters, myself included, back in the good old days, you know, and Mac, Tony's, for instance, certainly posted several things every day.
Yeah.
Brewer only posts, you know, once or twice or three times a month. But what he makes, what he lacks in quantity, he makes up for in quality. And even if I don't always agree with what he's writing thought-provoking things. He was big on the David Jacobs, Emma Woods story.
Yeah.
He's written stuff dealing with the sort of alien abduction thing, but also MJ-12. I mean, he covers the gamut, and he looks at it both from a cultural point of view, but I think he also takes an interest in the phenomenon as well. And that's kind of rare, because usually, you know, you might get one or the other. Mosley was one, for instance, and Mac was one of those guys who went both ways. And Brewer seems to be one of those guys, too. So it's well worth a read, and it's well worth winning, in my opinion, and Zorgi's opinion, a 2014 Zorgi Award for Best Paranormal Website or Blog.
I agree. I think it's a really good one. I hadn't been too familiar with it. I'd seen it here or there, but his write-up, I just read it today because I hadn't been there in a while, on the what's it called? Project Core, this massive sort of data collection of narratives from experiencers.
Yeah.
He sort of has a take on that is really very balanced and well thought out. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, he's all for it. I went and looked at it, but I didn't. I turned into a too long didn't read because I was coming into the show, and I was like, okay, I'll read this later. And I was surprised to see that Jeremy Vaney and Jeff Ritzman had sort of led the charge on this, and I'd heard about this before, but it surprised me that they had gotten, I looks like, credentialed, you know, researcher, scientist type people to. Do this study with them on people that claim some kind of paranormal experience and what their backgrounds were and, you know, what their, I don't know what they ask, income, like history of mental illness, have you ever been incarcerated? I don't know. But all these questions that I thought, hey, why don't we ask people like weird ass questions that seem like they have nothing to do with the thing and that nobody, you know, with the experience and nobody's asked before and see if there's some kind of correlation. Apparently they came up with created more questions than answers, but really good questions.
Right, which is what, you know, some good research does is it points the direction to you know, future direction, points the direction to future directions. That's really good. But it points the way to new avenues for exploration. And I mean, you look at this and the two guys who came up with it, Vaney and
Ritzman.
Ritzman, I read this and I read their other stuff and their whole thing with Jacobs a few years ago over the Emma Woods thing, and I was like you, I was a bit surprised to see this coming from those two guys. Not a knock against them, it just seemed, you know,
it seemed out of character. Yes,
right.
And I was pleasantly surprised. I hope I am. Yes. I'm going to read up more on it.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing where you look at what MUFON's doing nowadays with Hangar One and whatever, and you look at what these two guys are sort of doing off on their own, and you're sort of thinking, well, shouldn't MUFON be doing things like this if they are what they say they are?
Yeah,
shouldn't they be engaged in this sort of research?
Yes, exactly. Who was the head of MUFON for a while? I had him on, James Carrion. He was pushing this kind of stuff. He talked about it on my show. It gave me all this hope, and then he quit, or he was pushed out or something. And, you know, one of the things I've been banging on the wall about, like, for 2 or 3 years, saying small groups, a few people, a few researchers, just taking it in a different direction. This is one of those things. So, because of Paul's award here for Brewer and his support of the core project, I actually sat there trying to fight my apathy, and the apathy lost. I was pleasantly surprised.
I when I first heard about Project Core, when it was first announced, I looked at it and I thought, oh, good, a bunch of stories. You know, I was like, and that's great. And that's fine. And then I looked at the survey and I was like, you know what? There's probably, you know, demographically and everything, some good data here that can drive some things.
Yeah.
So
I hope so.
Yeah.
If nothing else, it's a good starting point to a conversation. Not as I believe in the comments section at Brewer's blog, Tyler Kokjun, who was one of the scientists who was involved.
I read those comments.
Yeah, and he responded to Lance Moody, who I quite like, and we'll be talking about Lance a little later because there's one more award that I forgot to send to you guys. But Lance had made some snarky and some well-informed comments, too.
Yes,
about he
made both. He does that. That's fine.
Yes. And Kokjun responded that, you know what, you've raised a good point. These are things that we should look at, your criticisms or your observations about maybe some of the limitations. Or I think what Lance was talking about in particular was a lot of the people who reported self-described themselves as above average intelligence.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's either true, maybe they really are above average, or, you know, it might be an indication that these people are not necessarily completely anchored in reality.
Right.
Because,
and that's one of those things that further, you know, further delving into can weed out. And I liked Kokjun's response because it wasn't, you know, you horrible skeptibunker. How dare you? You know, what are you doing to, you know, blah, 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 the usual Facebook comment thread sort of, you know, skeptic slap fight thing. But, you know, it was like, yes, this is what scholars do. Scholars say, that's a good critique. I'll work it into my research, you know?
Yeah.
Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, in the real world of doing research, people don't take every critique as, you know, some sort of existential, you know, disaster.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, really, are you sure you're actually in academia, Aaron? Because my experience with academia is a lot of researchers do take it as an existential crisis. It's like, oh, my God, you don't agree with me? I'm not going to get tenure? Ah.
It can be like that. And there's, you know, some fun letters columns in journals and stuff. But, you know, in general, if it's a good, valid critique, you know, sometimes the critiques themselves, you know, are, you know, very much personal and all that stuff. And,
yeah, if you look at it like a journal, like I used to read, I don't really much now, but I used to read the Journal of Scientific Exploration,
mm-hmm.
and there were, every time somebody brought up, and sometimes on their website and stuff, people brought up valid points. They said, how did you get this information? What did you, you know, how did you come to this conclusion? I have come to a different conclusion. Anyway, there was like lively debate based on the facts, lack thereof, or different facts, which is wonderful. What happened? Is somebody is somebody putting a breath spray in, it sounds like?
I'm sorry, I've got a cough. I'm trying to hide it as much as I can.
Oh, you don't have a cough button. Okay, sorry.
No,
I've got
a kind of mute switch I can hopefully activate in time. So.
Okay.
Nice.
So
I was only half serious about the academia thing. I spend enough time in academia to know there's a lot of good people who, you know, the give and take. And this is one of the great myths, I think, that believers in particular have about science and academia, is that, you know, they're hidebound and resistant to change, and you can't have an honest discussion. And for the most part, nothing is further from the truth.
Nope.
People want to have that honest discussion.
They're
more about raising questions, and then they usually, not always, but usually welcome the give and take, because that's how you learn things. That's how you make discoveries, whether it's in history or whether it's in physics.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's, to anybody who's been in academia, generally speaking, that's how it works. Not always, but generally speaking, it's not the other way around.
Yeah, and when my students beef up your argument too. Go ahead.
Yeah, when my students bring up ancient alien stuff, because they all do that now, and I hate it.
Of course they do.
But the guy with the hair. But Giorgio, I think.
Sukulishalusalolokas.
Yeah, Greek guy. Sukulos. When they bring that up, and I say, you know, sometimes you hear the criticism that establishment historians don't want the truth known because, you know, then their books would be obsolete. I say, look at the cover of your book. What does that say? Fourth edition. That's right. Fourth edition. We find out new stuff all the time. They simply do a new edition and you can't sell your book back. Yeah. They want new stuff because that means more money.
The only time it really causes a problem is something like, you know, if you're Hugh Trevor Roper and you stick your neck out for something like the Hitler Diaries, and then, you know, those are revealed to be fraudulent, most of your reputation as a historian goes, you know, into the trash can, and that's what you're remembered by. So there's always a little bit of risk there. But those kinds of epic failures or disasters are pretty rare. Usually, you know, historians are not making those kinds of claims. So there's always that wiggle room that allows you to kind of, yes, I've revised my opinion. Oh, we have new information. Files were released, or we found a new witness, if you will, or whatever. Yeah. And it's almost like an appeals process in the law. Sure, we convicted this guy, but 2 years later, we have new evidence. Well, let's reassess. And now we know he's innocent, so let's let him out, and that sort of thing. So that kind of revision process, by and large, takes place in almost everything. So it's not like, you know, as the true believers point, you like often to say, you're all against us, and you'll never change your mind, and you have a vested interest, and anything, you know, nothing is further from the truth, really.
You know who's against them? The loudest people are against the loudest people. That's all that happens. The loud people that believe are going to whine and bitch and moan about the loud people who disbelieve. And
exactly.
That's just the way it works. I mean, you always hear the loudest opinion, especially on something fringy. And, you know, as things go forward, I hope, well, people won't because they don't. But I want to try and push, along with my friends and all this, people that are being circumspect and people that, welcome some kind of criticism and either consider it and say, this is, you know, this makes sense, or they don't consider it and say, well, you don't have a case there. And the other thing about skeptics, and some people have problems with me saying this, and I pulled this off of Robert Anton Wilson, there's a difference. There are fundamentalist skeptics, who are people that are basically believers, and there are skeptics, who are people that don't accept all the information, and they try to weigh it and see what conclusion they can make, even if it's no conclusion. Yes. That's what skepticism is. Fundamentalist skepticism is just another form of belief.
Yes.
Anyway, so we'll move on.
Yeah. I've got a honorable mention for best paranormal website. This might infringe on one of the later categories, but whatever Rich Reynolds is calling his blog these days, the RRR group, UFO iconoclasts, UFO con, whatever.
UFO conjectures.
Conjectures, that's it. I'm not sure if best is the right word, but certainly one of the most interesting over the last year. And we've got some stuff that appearing in a later award category down the road here, but I was for a long time, for most of the year, that was usually a weekly check-in for me, was what was going on over there and the comment threads and some very interesting stuff, and sometimes some really good conjecture, and a lot of times a lot of fluff and personalities, but there was some good stuff there this year. Not good as far as interesting and pushing the conversation, not necessarily good as in, you know, absolute sort of truth or anything, but it was, there were some fun times.
I think the difference between, and I, you know, Rich's blog, you know, Rich, I consider a friend, and I probably look at it almost every day. His, the difference between him and Brewer is Brewer takes it seriously pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. Whereas Rich is a provocateur, so you can never be quite sure just how serious he's being about anything. And he's a little Mosley-esque with a Joseph McCarthy twist. So, and I can
yeah,
say that.
Yeah, that's what I would
he's
say.
He's an
yeah.
old John Bircher, and he's a fan of McCarthy. So, you know, he's a cantankerous guy, and he does raise interesting questions, usually about once a week or once every 2 weeks. And then there's a lot of, if you like the cesspit that is the personality-driven drama of ufology, it is the blog to go to, mm-hmm. because sooner or later, something will wind up in the comments section or one of Rich's posts, and it'll blow up. And I've been part of that myself over the years over there. And it's kind of fun. It's like sort of pro wrestling.
Yes.
In a sense. How much of it is real and how much of it is not real? Who knows and who cares? But it's a fun read. And yes, if I had an honorable mention section, I agree with you, Aaron, absolutely. That would have been my honorable mention.
Yeah. It's funny you mention him now, and I don't read him as often anymore because I've stopped caring about who's fighting with who. But if you had to say that somebody had taken over Jim Mosley's mantle, Rich Reynolds would probably be pretty close.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree. Thoroughly disliked by all the right people. So
yes.
And once I got that he was a provocateur, and he contacted me off list a few times a few years ago and said, look, don't take this all so seriously. I like what you do, so don't worry about it. And I totally got it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on to the next one. The 2014 Zorgi Award winner for Best Paranormal Facebook Group. Who's that, Paul?
Oh, my God. Now there's an award for best. When I started this, Facebook didn't exist.
Yeah, you told me to get on Facebook because Mac told you to do it.
No, actually, Mac hated Facebook.
Oh, did he? Okay.
It was Chris McBride that turned me on to Facebook.
Okay, yeah, because you said, get on Facebook. It's quite interesting. And this is like, what, 2006 or 7 or something?
Yeah, 7, I think. He was a Twitter guy. He hated Facebook. In fact, I think before he died, he dismantled his account. So while his Twitter account still exists, his Facebook account, he took it down, I think, before he passed away.
Yeah.
In terms of the so here you go. First time award. UFO updates, which used to be the email listserv of all listservs for 10 or 15 years that every researcher was on. It's kind of like a master's course in ufology. And Errol Bruce Knapp, who's one of the great unsung sort of figures in ufology over the last, say, 20 years, finally stopped doing it. But then he started a Facebook page, and I don't think he moderates it nearly with the iron fist that he used to with the UFO updates listserv.
Oh, no.
But it's kind of Mosley-esque in the sense that you get sometimes people will post serious stuff. I think there's over 1,500 members now, too, which is pretty good for a UFO Facebook page.
Yeah.
So there's serious stuff. And then there's also a lot of what I would call kooky fringe stuff. And then there's some funny stuff, too. And the only time that Errol, I think, ever really intervenes is if somebody posts something to do with Stephen Greer. Because I think he prohibits any Greer-related postings. But other than that, you know, it's pretty much a free-for-all, which is kind of what the UFO updates list used to be.
Yes.
So as an old-time – I mean, I met Mac Tonies through the UFO updates list, so I have fond memories of it for that, if nothing else. So there's a few flame wars, and a lot of it seems to be about MUFON this year. But if you want to get the pulse of what's going on in ufology as a subculture, the UFO updates Facebook page is not a bad place to go.
And one of the things, and I think this came up last time I was on here with Greg, is that where is ufology nowadays? If you take the pulse, it is solidly moving towards the exopolitics camp as being the default ufology. There's a lot of that on there, and it's not immediately shouted down as, oh God, ufology, get, or exopolitics, get, go away, you know, except for Greer, who should go away. But, there's a lot of it out there. I think my favorite thing, one of my favorite things all year has been Elizabeth Trutwin's tweet storm appeals that we should, you know, tweet with hashtags for, you know, disclosure. And,
she is so refreshing. She has a Michelin star for kookiness. I love Elizabeth Trutwin. She's pure, unadulterated gold, comedy gold, her posts with the tweet storms. That stuff is great.
My favorite was somebody, I think it might have been Shepard Johnson, commented something, you know, like, this is stupid or something like that. something along those lines. And her comment was, you know, this long, long, long comment. And the gist of it was, why not just sign the petition? You're doing all this hand-wringing about this when you could just be signing the petition and moving towards disclosure. And it's just all these criticisms just go completely over her head. Nobody's hand-wringing here, lady. Nobody is wrestling with whether or not we should have disclosure. No. And that's the thing for them. The decision is, in their minds, people are trying to make up their mind whether to support disclosure or not support disclosure. The idea that there might be nothing to disclose, that doesn't even occur to them.
Yeah.
What there is to disclose
has nothing to do with what they think it is.
Right.
Possibly.
On the UFO updates thing, she seems like a very sincere person, I guess is what I should say.
Absolutely. She's, as many of the exopolitics folks are, she is very sincere. They're not bad people.
No.
But in her case, it's sincerity mixed with tone-deaf craziness that she is on the fringe of even the exopolitics stuff. And for folks who might not be aware, this is kind of an inside shop UFO ufology thing. The tweet storm, I have to laugh every time I say that. The rain. What is it, Stephen Bassett's motto? Let it rain. So
while he slaps himself on the butt.
Yeah. It was this thing that Bassett, who's constantly trying to convince people that he's a legitimate lobbyist, came up with, because everything he's come up with before now hasn't worked. So, it's like the old evangelical preacher. You have to come up with something new to keep the folks filling the pews every week. So this was his latest thing. We need a tweet storm on Washington. So everybody go to your Twitter accounts and tweet the White House and tweet your members of Congress and hashtag disclosure and ask them, say we want hearings, congressional hearings on disclosure. So I have to give Elizabeth Trutwin credit, because the only time I have ever hashtag disclosure, I thought, well, this is great, but not really the way I want to go. So I would tweet things like to members of Congress, Stephen Bassett is a UFO lunatic. And then I'd put hashtag disclosure, go tweet storm. Right? And I did that for about a week, and I was posting them on UFO Updates, the Facebook page, too. And, some people thought they were funny, and I think we all know who they were. And she never commented on them, though. No. That's the thing that I found very odd. Here's a guy who's making fun of you and making fun of your hero, Bassett, and she just kind of ignored it. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I kind of was trying to draw her out and have a little fun with her. And she just kind of figured, this isn't worth it. We're just going to keep our head down and move forward. I kind of admire that single-minded determination. As long as, it's not put in the service of Nazism or something evil. It's a good thing.
One of the things that made me feel very, very old is that the whole thing, didn't Bassett do this million facts thing?
Yes.
Back in the day, we were supposed to fax. It's like, it's just the same thing. It's just cheaper. But
cheaper and easier to ignore, because it's not gumming up your fax machine.
My favorite part was where he was going to send like an 8-DVD set of something to every member of Congress.
Oh, I think he did, didn't he?
Oh, my gosh.
You know how many of those were watched? Probably zero.
None.
I don't know whether he did it. Sorry, Aaron, didn't mean to interrupt. I don't know whether he actually did it or not, because I think he had, and I learned this from UFO Updates, I think he had a falling out with the producers of the fake hearings, who were really film producers. And, there's sort of a backstory on this, and give me just a minute here to tell this story. Before Bassett and I completely fell out at the 2008 Laughlin conference with the infamous ass slap in my face, after I tried to give him some good advice, which was stop inviting lunatics and start inviting serious people, and you might make a difference, Steve. And when I was at the X conference, he pigeonholed me in a room. Well, I pigeonholed him first, because he had a reputation for not paying people. And my uncle Stan Friedman warned me, don't leave the X conference without getting Bassett to pay you. So he owed me $500. That was my fee. And I said, Steve, I need this. I'm leaving tomorrow. So he finally paid me. But while I was there, as he's handing me over the money, he says, look, I want to pitch you on this idea for a UFO documentary. You're the guy to do it. Showing that completely Stephen Bassett's totally insane, because he thought I was the guy who would do it. You'd be perfect, Paul. You're the guy. And what he meant by that was, you've demonstrated you can raise money for production. Yep. So you're the guy.
And you happen to be standing here, and I'm giving you the spiel that I give anybody else who has done any kind of film work.
Exactly. And the spiel was not quite the fake congressional hearings, but it was pretty close. His idea was, you know, we'll get some former members of Congress and we'll do interviews and stuff. He hadn't quite melded it into the hearings concept yet. But even back in that was September of 2007, he was already thinking of that as his big, great play. And he said, look, we can raise money. I can raise money, meaning him. And Paul, you can get Canadian taxpayers money and blah, 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 all the stuff that you do. And I said, keep counting. 350, 360, Steve, just give me my money so I can get back to the party. And, you know, that I just thought he's divorced from reality that he would be pitching me that idea. But I, you know, he finally found some folks who went in on it with him. And then being Stephen Bassett, apparently it blew up in his face because his ego just wouldn't allow anybody else to have their input. And so I don't know whether the DVDs or whatever actually ever get sent off to the members of Congress. Who knows? And my thing to him would be, Steve, it would be so much cheaper if you just uploaded them to the internet and sent them the digital files, which is how they probably want to watch them anyway. Sending DVDs, so 2008.
Yes.
You know, now you send, like, put it on a Vimeo account.
Really? 2008? How about 2004, 3, something like that?
Well, true enough. Yeah. Blu-rays would be 2008. Now, you know, everybody transfer, put it in Dropbox and send it to everybody.
Yep.
Yeah.
Repeats. You've got a better chance of having it seen. So anyway, there's some inside ufology stuff, but that's Stephen Bassett, who didn't win any awards this year. I don't want to give anything away, but he probably should. we should create a Stephen Bassett Memorial Award.
And just give it to Stephen Bassett every year, you know,
exactly.
Because he's going to be there for something anyway, so.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I'm drinking Death Valley Sour Green Apple Soda. It's very good.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, next category for your 2014 Zorgi Award winner for Best Paranormal Magazine. I will announce them and then let Paul do the announcement of the name or the entity.
Oh, sure, okay.
Best Paranormal Magazine?
Drumroll, a lot of folks might not know this one, is Sunlight, which is an e-zine published by Skeptic, Tim Printy.
It used to be printed, I think.
I don't know if he ever did a printed copy, but...
Well, he did something, because I remember seeing mentions of him in old issues of Saucer Smear, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe.
Anyway, go ahead.
But it's he puts them out every 2 months, and it is... Whether you agree or disagree with, and he's not the only contributor, other people contribute. He took apart the RB-47 case from 1957, I think a year or two ago. I didn't agree with everything he wrote, but a lot of it made sense. And certainly, again, comes into that ballpark of raising questions. So I had challenged him in a private series of emails. I said, look, Tim, instead of bashing Roswell all the time, which is easy, why don't you take on some of these really good cases? Take on, like, I don't know, take on RB-47,
yes,
which was number one in my film. And so, you know, what he did? He did. And he did a multi-page sort of expose, and folks can look at it and say, well, okay, here's his answer. Does that make sense? But at least, you know, he was not afraid. Again, one of these myths is skeptics are unafraid, or are rather afraid to tackle the sort of
good
best cases, if you will. He's not. There he goes. He did it. Easy peasy. So it's a really good magazine to read. He has a regular sort of roundup on what everybody's blogging about. Mm-hmm. He has a Roswell corner where he's always talking about Roswell. He reviews books and DVDs, and then he has columns about different cases and stuff. And if you want to know what the skeptical side is thinking, that's the place to go. But if you want to read something that's thought-provoking, a little funny sometimes too, he has a good sense of humor, it sort of follows in the footsteps of Phil Klass's old magazine, which is kind of why he calls it Sunlight. But it's a really good read, and even true believers shouldn't be afraid to go read it. But for the rest of us who are agnostics or skeptics or open-minded, whatever, it's kind of a must-read. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Okay. Well, I should give it a chance because it came from that Phil Klass school. It kind of scared me. It always has scared me. It's like, well, is this even worth my time? Because is it just going to be? Because my impression of Phil Klass, besides being kind of a nasty person, personally to some people who he didn't like, or even people he just held in contempt, was that his skepticism was more of the fundamentalist type. And when he did try to take apart cases, when he did find something legitimately wrong or something prosaic about the case, it was almost by chance. Or if something, it was really obvious. yes, he solved a lot of cases and put it into a doubt a lot of others. And then he had, you know, really stupid ideas for a few of them, too. So just to the point where he just got to the, he was like, I got to come up with something that explains this. I don't care how silly it sounds. And it probably didn't sound silly to him. And that's what scared me off of Printy's stuff. So now, listening to Paul, maybe I will check it out. In fact, I will.
I like it. It's some good stuff in there, but every issue I look at seems to have a lot of things with numbers and graphs and science. And
oh,
that confuses
no.
my history brain, and I just have to run away. But there's some good reasoning in there, and always I like the blog roundup. That's usually what I read, just because I don't have time to, you know, read all of these blogs. But honorable mention for best paranormal magazine. I kind of was thinking, where are all the paranormal magazines? Is this a category that's on its way out, really? Because it's just, I'm thinking back to the last time I was looking at the, I don't know, at Barnes & Noble or something, and I think Fate is still out there, and UFO Magazine, and I think Open Minds is publishing a magazine now, but I'm not sure what the place of the UFO magazine is anymore. I think it's got to be a webzine like Sunlight, because I don't know if anybody could make a go of a print newsstand UFO paranormal magazine anymore. I don't know where this is going, the magazines.
I don't know either. Ken Thomas just released a new print on demand of Steam Shovel Press, which in fact I have an article in. So he's trying to do it that way. So maybe some of it goes that way, but I think most people are too lazy to even order the print on demand.
Yeah.
So it's so much easier just to sit there and drool in front of your computer or your phone or whatever and read these things. So, oh, I'm not in the microphone. So I think that, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, that's the way things are going. They have been going for the last 10 or 12 years and will continue in that vein, I'm sure.
Yeah. Hewlett-Packard, HP has this, they used to a couple years ago, I think it's still around, called MagPrint, where you can publish a print-on-demand magazine and then through their app sell either physical copies or PDFs.
Yeah.
And I know there's I looked for paranormal stuff and I didn't see any UFO stuff last time I looked. A whole lot of ghost hunting stuff, which I'm not interested in, really, but it's some good stuff, and I think the print on demand thing, if it's going to keep going, that's the way people are going to have to do it. But even that, I mean, for the amount of money you put into writing and editing and soliciting articles,
yeah,
and laying out for, you know, at least if it's on a newsstand, somebody might see it. If it's in an app or on a website, your audience is going to be limited. It's going to be tough.
Really?
Steam Shovel Press, you know, you got a built-in audience there.
Yeah, I think that's
Thomas
a part
people,
of it.
So.
I think that, but the thing is, how many people go by newsstands anymore? I think there might be two left in the LA area that I know of. I mean, legitimate big newsstands that have all these print magazines.
Yeah.
Two of them are right near me, and I think it's like one's in Santa Monica, and there might be one in Pasadena, so maybe four, but they're really rare now, and they used to be like, you know, There were 10 of them around here not 10 years ago.
Yeah, it used to be, you know, you'd go, there'd be like the, you know, yeah, even growing up in the Midwest, there were these little in the strip malls or in the mall or in all of these places, you could go and there was 1,000 magazines you never heard of.
Yeah.
All sitting there, and they'd never be there the next month. Yeah. And I've got a whole bunch of weird UFO magazines from the 90s that had like one issue.
Yeah.
And it was great. I got this great one about Hale Bopp. it was like, is it the comet? Is it Wormwood from Revelation? It's this whole thing about the Vatican Observatory.
Or you can go to Barnes & Noble has a large newsstand too still.
Yeah. That's about – around here, that's about the only one – the only one I can think of.
It's part of what's happening everywhere. It's certainly in the media, and I mean, we're all older fellows. You know, we're not millennials. We're not even Generation Y. I don't even know what generation I'm in. I think it's Generation like P or
I think
Q.
We're all in the. I think we're all Generation X, vaguely.
Yeah, I think it's called middle age now. So yeah. At least it is for me. I turned 48 in a couple of days.
I hit the very beginning of Generation X.
I'm the very end. I'll be 40 next year. So.
Okay. God, I hate you. I hate you.
But, poor Paul. You know how old I am.
Well, yeah, there you go. So at least I'm in the middle. But films, it's the same way. I mean, fewer and fewer films, for instance, are actually being released in theaters. Mm-hmm. Theater, the idea of going to a theater is kind of like a cinema, is going the way that going to a theater where you would see plays is gone, which is it's becoming a fringe activity. And over the next 10 or 15 years, it'll become even fringier, where you'll see the big budget stuff. Usually when you go to a theater now, I know from our own theater, they run the really popular plays. So you don't see new theater certainly in small towns and cities in theater.
No.
And so where do you see movies? Well, a lot of the times you'll see them on things like HBO or Netflix or whatever, but you'll see them online too. People are independent filmmakers are making them and getting them directly to their consumers. And a lot of it's becoming that do-it-yourself kind of thing. And magazines, it's the same way. Big budget magazines can probably afford to stay in business, at least for the foreseeable future. But there's no such thing as a big budget UFO magazine. There never will be. The audience for it is too small. And so UFO magazine is out of business. Even the online version, the Burns, I guess, the Bill and Nancy Burns finally gave up and stiffed a lot of their subscribers too.
Ooh.
You know this for a fact?
Well, all you have to do is go to the UFO magazine blog and see the complaints from their subscribers saying, we didn't get our magazines. Why aren't you publishing anymore? Blah, blah, blah. You cashed my check kind of thing. So I haven't followed that lately, but there was an awful lot of complaints. And they said, we're stopping the print version. We're moving to an online version. And that didn't last.
Oh, that's the death knell right there.
Yeah. And Open Mind magazine, I guess, is defunct too. They don't publish anymore either. Shepard Johnson just posted a comment on Radio Mysterioso's Facebook page saying that Open Minds Mag is done as well. So, and there's a magazine out of the United Kingdom called Phenomenon Magazine, which is totally online. I don't think they have hard copies. So that's there's a startup magazine that just said, we're going straight online. Tim Crawford at UFO TV, he distributes it. And in the United States. So that's where people are going. And I'm not sure whether it's a good or bad thing, but when you say best magazine, you're almost certainly going to be referring now to something that's online in the paranormal realm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it's interesting that, all of these like Open Minds and Phenomena going straight online, that these have all, they're all sort of, I don't know. I guess I'm old. I see a magazine going from print to online as, oh, you're one. That's one foot in the grave right there. If it's born online, that's one thing. But when you've decided, oh, we're going to finish out your subscription that you've paid for a print magazine with our online version, or Omni did that back in 95 and it was gone by 96.
Yeah.
But the 40 in Times is still plugging along. Because I think 40 in Times is much, much broader and a little more small C Catholic in its approach. And I love 40 in Times. I wish I could. I wish I had time and money to buy it all the time and never stop reading it. But
they would get my honorable mention simply because they did a nice write up on the 2006 New Frontiers Symposium. So I have fond memories of 14 Times, and they are really, they actually reviewed my book too and didn't give it a bad review. They didn't give it a good review, but they gave it this is an okay book to buy review. So and you're right, they have that British sensibility about them too. So they would get my honorable mention. I just, Printy's, he's, the thing about Sunlight is he delves into cases, but he also delves into the sociology, the subculture of ufology. Mm-hmm. And it's really rare to find anything anymore that does both. So I guess it's kind of the same thing as, that I said when I, with the UFO Trail blog thing, the same kind of thing is true. There's a guy who sort of does a bit of both. And that's kind of what I like to look for is you get a bit of both.
Yeah, I think Fortean Times would get my vote just because a couple months ago, novelist and Doctor Who writer Paul Cornell did an article for them on the paranormal in 70s Doctor Who, which, you know, just sort of took everything I love and put it in one article. And I was like, this magazine just wins publishing for me because of that. So.
No, okay. You're such a Who. I was going to complain that you're such a Whovian, but I'm wearing my Doctor Who lounge pants as I do this interview, so I can't really. And I'm drinking out of a Doctor Who cup, so I can't really complain.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's pretty bad, Paul. Yeah. I mean that's serious.
You mean bad as in bad good or bad as in bad bad?
It's scary.
Oh, okay, good. That's there. You go. Mission accomplished. I could take them off. That would be even scarier.
Okay, what's the next? Is the next one paranormal? Best paranormal news site?
Sure. Yeah, you're running the show, so that works.
No, well, the thing is, I'm looking at these tiny, tiny little images that you sent on our conversation here, and I can't remember how many down we are on the list now. But we'll go with that, right?
It is best paranormal news site. And I think Aaron and I disagree a bit about this one, but the Zorgi Award goes, and Aaron will have the Aaron Award in a second. The Zorgi Award goes to the Daily Grail, which is put out by Greg Taylor out of New Zealand.
Whose birthday is today?
It is, although in Canada the birthday's already passed. But yeah, his birthday was the 28th or whatever Sunday was. It is a mix of news, but it's also a mix of opinion. He has a Red Pill Junkie writes for him, does a lot of the news summaries, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's really, I know Aaron likes The Anomalist, and I occasionally look on The Anomalist, but I've actually found the quality of The Anomalist has gone down a little bit over the last few years, whereas Greg has just stepped up his game. And the Daily Grail it really is a one-stop shop. When I post stuff on my Facebook page that says, oh, look, here's something cool that's paranormal, I've probably found it by taking a look at the Daily Grail newsfeed. And he goes a little further. He's a little more Catholic, if you will, Aaron, than The Anomalist, which seems to stick mostly to Bigfoot and Sasquatch and UFOs. The Daily Grail embraces a whole range of Fortiana that I don't find any other news sites do. Plus, Greg's a really good bloke, as he might say. So, the Zorgi goes to the Daily Grail.
I have not looked at the Daily Grail in a while, and I used to quite often, actually, when UFO Mystic was going strong and basically daily, I would look at the Daily Grail and make sure that I didn't repost something that he already did, because he was really good about combing the net for news. And the other thing is he publishes, what is that occasional journal he publishes? Is he still doing that?
Dark Lore.
Dark
yes.
Lore, yeah. Because I had one article in there. He faithfully sends me every year, no matter what it is, you know, no matter what I earned, even if it's a $2, he'll send me my little royalty thing and, on PayPal. So he's really scrupulous about being good to his writers. So he goes up, you know, many percent points in my book for that. So Aaron wanted to push. Did you have more you wanted to say about pushing The Anomalist as your runner up or your best paranormal news site? What happened to Aaron?
I don't know. Is Aaron still here? He hung up in anger when I called him out on The Anomalist, maybe.
Oh,
I don't know.
Sorry.
Oh, there he is. Just,
I had my cough button on. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Sorry about that.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah, hey, I looked at it's like his face is still there on
at least I know it works.
Yeah.
I like The Anomalist. I'll be honest, The Anomalous is just sort of where I go. I've got nothing against the Daily Grail. It's probably, as far as the range of news, better than The Anomalous, but I always end up going to The Anomalous for some reason. That's a pretty lackluster endorsement right there. But,
yeah, well, I have a soft spot for them, too, because they're from The Anomalous, which Patrick Huige runs, who have nothing but nice things to say about him.
Yeah, no, I have nothing bad to say about The Anomalist either, although I do think some of the write-ups are a little – whoever used to do the write-ups a couple of years ago I thought did a better job. But, you know, it's still – and the thing about The Anomalist that I have seemed to notice is they play favorites. So it seems to be you see a lot of the same blogs show up, and maybe they're not picking up on other things. Whereas the thing I find with the Daily, which is, it's a criticism of them. I still take a look at the Anomalous once or twice a week to just kind of catch up. But the Grail is something I look at every day because if nothing else, the news feed, they don't really offer a lot of commentary. It's just like, here's stories that might interest you. Boom, 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 boom. And, yeah. And I kind of like that. It's just kind of look, a quick summary that you can check every day.
Yeah, they vacuum cleaner up all that stuff for you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it makes life easy if you're running a paranormal blog or a Facebook page. It's like, here you go, kind of thing. But the anomalist is certainly, it would get my honorable mention. So I don't disagree with you.
Okay.
Much.
Well, I should have been looking at my list here. See, now we're to a point in here where I can't like count how many ones we've done. Paul, can you look at your little list there and see what's on there next?
Yeah, sure. It's the 2014. And maybe we could take a little break after this one because this might be just so I can grab a coffee or something.
Yeah.
The 2014 Zorgi for Best Paranormal Radio Show or Podcast.
Yeah, who got that, Paul?
The winner, drum roll, is Radio Mysterioso.
How did that happen?
It happened because your show is the only show that I go out of my way to listen to whenever I can. I can't always listen to it for different reasons if I'm busy or whatever. But if I have nothing to do, if I have the free time and I'm not asleep, because it starts at midnight in my time zone in Canada and runs till 2. You have the best, most eclectic range of guests. You play really cool, weird, funky music. And you're really the most open-minded, thought-provoking interviewer and I know you won't take offense when I say this, in your own sort of charming, clumsy kind of way, conversational kind of way. I mean that in a good, I love it. But it's a conversation. You have conversations. You don't have interviews.
Yeah. Well, you're right, Paul. It is actually on purpose sort of clumsy and conversational because I'm lazy. I don't like setting up for shows unless it's somebody like, for Dean Radin, I really set that one up because I didn't want to screw it up. I wanted to ask interesting questions. But like, when I have friends on that I know real well, I don't really set anything up because I just, I've got 3 or 4 subjects we're going to talk about. And then we just kind of BS through the whole thing. Not like we're doing here. Actually, we've got a kind of a framework to hang it on, which I should thank you for.
This is very structured.
Yeah. This is for this show. This is really structured. But yeah, I know what you're getting at. I think I know what you're getting at when you say it's, kind of dumb and clumsy. It's like, yeah, it's kind of on purpose because I just like to act like, not act like, but I just like to sit here and talk to people like I would talk to them anyway. Some of the guests, I have to remind them of that. I said, keep going. You don't have to just give me a canned answer. Nick, when he's on, he starts making noises like a chicken. That's perfect.
You should have him in a car in Puerto Rico and have him doing the pigeon sounds. It's the man, his pigeon imitation is gold, but I have some of it on video too. I'm going to have to post that someday. I never said dumb. In fact, your show is intelligent and clumsy is the wrong word. It's a calculated clumsy. It's, not clumsy, but sort of down homey, conversational, holistic. I don't know. Folksy. Boom. That's folksy. The word I'm looking for.
Folksy. Kind of folksy. Let's pull up the Cracker Barrel.
That's exactly what it is. I'll be honest. This is the only show that I've been interviewed on where if I know I'm going on Radio Mysterioso, one, tonight is great because I don't have to go to work tomorrow because I'm still on break. So
yay.
This is the only one where I'm not nervous all day. It's just as a guest, it's a very relaxing experience. So I find the, just knowing that I'm not going to be peppered with question, and have to have structured answers for these questions. So I like that, that fits how I talk. So
yeah,
I would add as honorable mentions, by the way, Banal of America, which I don't listen to as much as I used to, but I find Tim largely because I don't listen to as much paranormal radio as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
But I like Tim. I think he's a good interviewer. I think he's got a good show. And I would also give an honorable mention, Aaron. I know you've been on the show too. To Where Did the Road Go?
Yeah,
with Soraya Azkath. He's on terrestrial radio, I believe, out of Ithaca, New York.
Yep. Yep.
Somewhere in New York. And I've been on a couple times. I know you have. Greg, hopefully he has you on. He's a fun guy to talk to.
Never been on that show. In fact, I didn't even know about it till you just mentioned it.
Well, that's, I guess that's part of the Zorgies, isn't it? Yeah. Hopefully people can figure out. But he's a good guy. He's a smart yep. guy. And he asks some interesting questions. And sort of like your show, Greg, it's a conversation. He's not a hard and fast interviewer, like the Jimmy Church show or whatever that's just come up where the guy's trying to sound like he's, you know, Dan Rather meets Art Bell or whatever. And it just sounds ridiculous. The best yeah. paranormal radio shows are the ones that are really a conversation amongst people. And Soraya does that. Tim does that. But nobody yes. does it better than Greg Bishop.
Well, thank you. I don't know what to say except thank you. And
if I can suck up a little more, one of the things that I honestly, when I'm out mowing the lawn or attempting to run or driving a long distance, Radio Mysterioso is the only podcast where I will go back years and grab episodes I know I like and listen to them over and over again.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I don't even do that.
So your interviews with Bill Moore, for example, yeah. Are great. The one with you, and I've mentioned this before, you and Walter Bosley and Ralph Kuhn, where it just gets weird. And there's Walter's talking about some really strange stuff with caves and magic glasses and all sorts of things.
Yes.
I just love that. And it's because it doesn't sound like a podcast interview. It sounds like three guys talking about some really cool shit. So, it has re-listenability.
One of my favorite memories of anything to do with the paranormal subculture is the 2006 interview in studio where it was Greg, me, and Mac Tonies.
Yeah.
And we just rambled on for almost 3 hours. And then we went out and had pie. So, but you know, that kind of, I have nothing but fun. I love going out to LA. I haven't done it in a while and sitting in the studio. I've done it with Walter Bosley. I've done it with Mac and, you know, Greg's always there. Holly Stevens, my Ghost Cases co-host, was there once. Even Don Ecker. Don Ecker and
yeah,
I managed to coexist without killing each other.
Episode.
Yeah. You know, it's always fun. Greg can sort of smooth over paper over the differences, between just about anyone. And yeah, there's some really weird stuff. There's some cool stuff. There's a lot of stuff I don't agree with. Doesn't matter. It gets me thinking. And the best part, he almost never mentions Donald Kehoe.
That's true. That's true. That's a downer.
I'm gonna have to start mentioning Donald Kehoe. Well, no, maybe I won't.
No, I think there's another radio show that has that covered for everybody. So, but you know, we'll just move on from there.
I actually heard that episode with you and Mac in the studio. The first time I heard that was I was actually driving down from Cimarron to Roswell, New Mexico. So I was actually on the road to Roswell when I listened to that for the first time, and it was back in 2006. I think it was very shortly after it actually was broadcast.
Yeah, Cimarron is actually, I believe, near where, what's her name? The woman that was abducted at the beginning of Project Beta. That actually happened in that area of the state right near Cimarron.
Okay. Yeah, I was, my wife worked for the Boy Scouts at the time, so I had a free trip to Philmont where she had some training. So,
oh, okay.
I was like, if I'm sleeping in a tent for a week, can I go to Roswell? And she's like, I guess if you have to. I have to.
It's a pilgrimage. You wouldn't understand.
It is. There's nothing like sleeping in the Roswell Super 8 in between two rooms full of itinerant construction workers, which is where I was. So
Myrna Hansen.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Myrna Hansen. That abduction was near Cimarron, actually. She was from Eagle's yep. Nest, New Mexico.
Yeah.
But the thing happened near Cimarron.
I've been to Cimarron, too. All three of us, I guess, have been there. Have you been there, Greg?
I have not been to Cimarron. Oh, the furthest I've been that direction is Angel Fire, which is not real close, but it's a lot closer than Roswell and Albuquerque and all that. Northeast corner of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Extreme northeast corner, like near the Oklahoma and Texas Panhandle area.
Yeah, it's you're almost in Colorado.
My brother and I were vacationing there, and we drove through, got hit by a huge, I mean, massive thunderstorm once, and just outside Cimarron. So, lovely country, though. Beautiful country.
All right.
That's our travel log for the night. It's lovely country, Cimarron. By the way,
beautiful country up around there.
We stayed in the Econo Lodge when we filmed Stan Friedman Is Real in Roswell, Aaron. So, we weren't that far from the Super 8. Probably should have stayed at the Super 8.
I've stayed in that Econo Lodge, too. I think they. Oh, no. The one time I was put up, it was in the Roswell, like Ramada or something like that. I've spoken there twice, but yeah, they both put us up in okay places. Not great. One of the Roswell things I went to, there were no hotel rooms. I had to stay in, what's that mountain community over there where they have the horse racing?
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, it's like in between Roswell and Alamogordo and the mountains there. But it was like 60 miles away.
Oh, jeez.
I had to stay there like two nights with a couple of friends of mine because we couldn't get rooms in Roswell the whole time. It was so packed. It was 97. It was the 50th anniversary one, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, and then I know what it was. Somebody, a researcher that couldn't make it, or they like had to give up their room, so we got their room. We ended up staying next to Stan Friedman, Uncle Stan, and my friend Ralph kept crank calling him his room. He'd call his room and say, "Release the files," and hang up. Then he'd call his room and hold the phone up to like a Warner Brothers cartoon that was on the TV, and he'd hang up.
I just remember when we were filming there in July of 2001, I shared a room with Stan because the other crew members were all sharing rooms. And so Stan and I had a room together. And as we were going in, if you've ever been to New Mexico, Roswell, and they're plagued by locusts. It's like Moses is there going, "Yes, I shall damn you all, Egyptians." And so the place is plagued by locusts, and you can't open the door to go into the motel room with about 50 of the little bastards getting in. And so I hate bugs. And you know, Stan doesn't bat an eyelid. We go in. It's like, okay, Stan brushes his teeth. He's in bed. I'm looking at all these locusts, you know, crawling around in the ground. I said, "Stan, what are we going to do about this?" And then I hear, he's already asleep. So I spend an hour swatting locusts with my shoes on the floor, the wall. I had the lights on. Nothing could wake Stan up. No matter how much noise I made, the man just slept through everything.
Hey, Ralph's listening now.
Oh,
the guy just talked about it. He said, "That's right. I did that. I slid shit under this door, too."
We've now revealed the secret of how half of the Roswell story began. It's Greg's friend, Ralph.
Yeah.
Plague of the locusts. Anyway.
I stayed in the, what's the name? Arco Santi, which is a kind of a hippie commune thing north of Phoenix, up in the mountains there, before you get to, you know, like halfway or a third of the way to Sedona. They've got really cheap rooms there because it's like it's some commune made up by this built by this Italian architect. It's been going for like 40 years or something. I'm not even sure if he's still alive. But anyway, I stayed there one summer a couple days with a friend of mine, and the entire road in there, must have run over like 100 tarantulas. And when we're staying in the room, there were scorpions crawling the walls in the room while we were trying to go to sleep.
That reminds me of why I've never been back to New Mexico after 2004. So yeah,
that was Arizona, but yeah, I mean, New Mexico has some. And David Childress's house, I've been there when he's gone. You open the front door, and there's like three or four dead scorpions in between the screen and the front door. You have to like kick out of the way. And then a couple inside. Luckily, he has white carpet on in his living room, so you go in and you can actually find like two or three dead scorpions in there too that you can throw out.
Deserts.
Here's two guys who live in the north. It's like blah.
I was in Texas this summer, and all I can say is they can keep the chiggers and fire ants. That stuff is just horrible.
It is. We have fire ants here now in Nova Scotia. Yeah.
Jesus,
my parents.
How do they survive the winter?
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, our winters are getting milder, and we live in a temperate, you know, we're on the Gulf Stream. But my parents, a lot of people in Halifax, their yards are plagued by them. You go sit in my parents' backyard in Dartmouth across the harbor, you know, they'll crawl up your legs and chomp chomp. Now, they're not as mean and evil as the New Mexican fire ants, which
I've
seen.
They're Canadian fire ants. They're nasty. Very polite.
Yeah, they're polite fire ants, but they pack a punch. They're nasty, nasty critters, and they've moved up here. So, yeah.
Man.
Global warming at work.
Yeah, and there is a theater in Beverly Hills named the Fire Ants, too, as you know.
That's right, the Fire Ant Theater. Yeah.
There's a theater on Beverly, and it's in very lovely cursive script that says fine arts, But if you look at it, we were driving on Wilshire once, and Paul said, "Does that say Fire Ants?" And it does. It looks like it says Fire Ants Theater.
Yeah, I'm going to have to post a picture of that because I have a photo of that somewhere. And if you glance at it real quick, it does look like Fire Ant Theater. And I thought, well, not sure I want to see a show there.
Did you want to take a break, Paul, and play some music so you can get a coffee or something?
I don't know. How are you guys doing? I could barrel through until the end, I guess.
Okay, yeah, I was going to play a Chinese version of Jambalaya, but, you know, we can go ahead.
Yeah, it's already 12:20. Yeah, let's just keep going.
Okay, let's just all keep right. going. And I all did right. have the next one up here. 2014 Zorgi Award winner for Best Paranormal Researcher, but...
There can be only one choice. It's like Highlander. There can be only one. And before I announce who the winner is, so that people don't think this is just, you know, me giving my friends awards, what's a researcher? Because I'm not a researcher. No offense to either of you two guys, but when it comes to the paranormal, while we've all done some research at some times, it's
heavy
not
at times, but not
right.
not year in year out quality stuff. No,
exactly. Who's the one guy that I know of that does that year in, year out, publishes book after book after book?
Don't turn
that
around.
Research.
There'll be a book.
Nick Redfern.
That's right.
And, you know, whether you like what he says or whether you don't like what he says or whether you agree or disagree with him, doesn't matter. The guy is an accumulator of information. My honorable mention would go to John Greenwald, who is an accumulator of information, too, with his Black Vault site. Mm-hmm. But Nick is a guy who actually takes that information and then he puts it into a, you know, book form or article form, gets it out there. And then he follows up. You know, he'll troll the blogs that are talking about his work or his research, and he'll engage with people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's that kind of it's almost an academic kind of thing. So he's got everything. He is the MVP of paranormal researchers. And I would also say he's not just a UFO researcher. In fact, the UFO stuff is just a side thing.
Yeah.
He does as much research about Bigfoot and Chupacabra and cryptozoology and all that sort of stuff. He has occasionally even gotten into ghosts and other areas of the paranormal. So he's very much a sort of holistic kind of guy. There's you know, honestly, there's nobody better, nobody harder working than Nick. You know, it's his gig. So it's somebody's going to have to work very hard, in my mind, to dethrone him as best paranormal researcher.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's – I mean, Greenwald with the Black Vault stuff, I mean, as far as accumulation of data and information, I mean, it's great. But Redfern has that that interpretive aspect to it as well. He's getting the information and he's presenting it – along with most usually an argument. It's almost never just here's some stuff that happened, do what you want with it. It's, you know, he's got a point of view.
Yeah, and he's not just, there's nothing wrong, by the way, with being a so-called armchair researcher.
No.
You can do archival research from your home now, and that terminology, I hate that term.
Yeah.
You know, people use it as a put-down. Because Nick is, in some respects, an armchair researcher. He does a lot of his research from home. But he also goes out in the field. I know, I've been in the field with him. His interviewing technique is solid. You know, he doesn't have a master's degree in oral research methodology, but he's developed a very good, solid research interview technique in the field. I've watched him do it. He keeps copious notes, which he still uses these little flip pads and everything, and he takes handwritten notes and bases a lot of what he does in terms of his books on conversations he's had that he keeps the notes on. I mean, he's just got it all. He works, he's diligent, he works really hard. And I know people, they kind of look at him with his rock and roll persona and he's cool Nick and his black shirts and everything. And he has a bit of that too. But
that's Nick. He doesn't, it's not a put on. Yeah. That's Nick.
No, that's who he is. But he is a really solid researcher. And no matter what you think of the work that he turns out as a result of it, you know, it's work based on his research. And often it's not really even his opinion. I know Final Events, which is one of my favorite books that he's written.
Yeah,
right. I agree with almost none of the things that are in it. I just find it a really cool read. But Nick would be the first person to tell you, look, these aren't my opinions. These are what people told me. This is the story I was given. Yes. I'm telling you that story. You can figure
make
out
of it
for yourself
what you want.
Yeah. And that's perfectly valid, too. That's historians do that all the time, you know.
Yeah, It's what I like about Final Events, especially, is this is a book. Is as I'm reading it, I can. The one thing I kept thinking was this would make a great, you know, film or documentary of him talking to these people and trying to find out, you know, what's behind some of these stories. And that's one of the things I like about his books is especially the ones where his sort of work as a, or his talents as a journalist come out, and we see him through his eyes interacting with these people. There's some of that in The Body Snatchers in the Desert as well. And I just think that's very, it's fun to read. It's not just good information. It's a good read as well.
Yeah. He's a good writer. I still think his best book is Three Men Seeking Monsters, which
he wrote
15 years ago. Him, Richard Freeman, and John Downs, you know, shuttling around the United Kingdom in their Scooby bus looking for not even really looking for monsters, just getting drunk
around
and sort of wandering into places that might have monsters. And the interesting thing for me about Nick is he's a natural for television. And I don't just mean a talking head like Dolan on Hangar One or something. I mean, Nick's a natural to be fronting a television series. And he's never done it. Nobody's ever asked. As far as I know, no one's ever asked him to do it. He's never been given that opportunity.
I've got an idea for Nick. And if he gets out here, I'm going to shoot some stuff with him and I don't know, do something with it.
He's gold. I've seen him in the field. I'd love to do something. If I was still doing that kind of stuff, I'd love to do something with him too. He's just gold. He's I can't say enough good things about him. So he really.
I don't think there's anybody even close. That even the stuff that's in his books that's been around for a while. I know some of the in his Men in Black book. There's some things in there that I'd read them other places. He makes them fresh. He makes them new. His books, and he's prolific enough, and he's on enough actual bookshelves and brick and mortar stores that I think he's one of the few writers out there now that's actually grabbing people and pulling them into this stuff. As opposed to some of the others who just talk a lot more about what they're doing for, quote, the field or whatever. I think there's going to be the next generation of people in 10 years who, well, how did you get into this? I read a Nick Redfern book, you know, and that's how they're going to get into it. There's nobody else even close.
Yeah, the two things I'd say about Nick to add to all that, and I think Paul kind of touched on it, is one, he's not wedded to anything he writes. It's not, right. He doesn't sit there and bang on. It's like, I'm right and you're wrong. He's that what we were talking about earlier about the academia and people being open to criticism and changing their opinions or at least saying, you know, maybe I better look into that a little closer, or no, I hadn't heard that before, whatever. He's really mellow about that. He's very he's secure enough in his method that he doesn't care if people starts chopping down what he found out. He just kind of says, well, either I didn't consider that before, or you're not making any sense. I mean, he treats everybody pretty fairly. And the other thing is, and people probably don't know this, but Nick is probably one of the most generous people I've ever seen with information. Just like information he's picked up somewhere that he's either used, might use, hasn't used yet. He'll just give it right out to you. He's like, oh, you're writing about this? I found out this. And like, you get a half an hour of information you never heard of.
Yes, he's a good colleague.
Yeah, he's a good colleague and just the most unselfish person. So, yeah, he deserves the best paranormal researcher of the year. Not just this year, but probably others. But I'm glad that we were able to suck up to Nick a bit. next one. Oh, now we move into the at least one of the negative categories. Zorgi Award winner for lamest paranormal story of the year.
Well, before we get to that one, there was one award that I forgot to send along to you, so we might as well slide that in
real
quick.
We've got 35. No, you know what? We got as much time as we want. There's not a show after me. Go ahead.
Oh, perfect. It's the Zorgi Award for Best Skeptic, and that one goes to Lance Moody, who is, I know he pisses everybody off sooner or later, including me. He's pissed me off too over the years. But he's the guy who exposed Phil Imbrogno's phony claims. He's done real research into not just the personal claims, things like Imbrogno, but into cases, again, like Tim Printy does. He, unlike Printy, he shows up on other people's blogs, like Rich Reynolds. You'll find him there. He'll comment on Kevin Randall's blog. He used to be a regular participant on the Paracast forums until Gene banned him, I think, for not towing the party line or whatever. So he engages with the believer, if you will, community, too. And he usually does it in a pretty snarky way, but once you get to know him, he's actually, you know, a pretty, he's a really nice, friendly guy. It's just the stupidity of the believers, the really true believers, that really irks him. And sometimes it sends him a little too far. And even he'll admit, unlike Phil Klass, who would never have admitted it, Lance will say, "I went too far. I'm sorry." You know, but then he'll say, "Well, here's the information though. Here's my take on it." So he's an honest skeptic. He's a thoughtful guy, and he's got a little of Jim Moseley in him. Plus, he knew Jim very well and actually interviewed him. There's a video interview, I think, of Moseley up that Lance did several years ago. So it's one of the rare times you can watch Moseley on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so, Lance would be my skeptic of the year. There are, you know, there's other guys too. You can find a lot of them at UFO Updates on the Facebook page, guys like Robert Schaefer and other people, even John Shirley. The author engages in skepticism. He's kind of fun.
I've had him on my show a couple times, and we've gotten into it.
Yeah, yeah. But they don't do it with the sort of regular glee that, although I really like Schaefer's blog. He, what's it called? Bad UFOs, I think.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's, you don't always have to agree with what he's writing, but there's interesting conversations that take place there. But yeah, Lance,
I almost never agree with what he's writing. But that's a prejudice.
There you go. But he's a provocateur again. But I like Lance, so Lance gets my skeptic of the year.
Has he ever told you why he does what he does?
Why he's interested in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's his attitude, which I hope it is. I really want to get further with knowing what this is, and I'm really tired of the BS. Is that basically what you would say his modus operandi is?
He's never phrased it quite like that, but I think that's definitely part of it, which is why I say he's an honest skeptic. I think he actually finds it interesting. He's very well-versed.
Some of them are into it just because they like bothering people and they hate it, the UFO hater people.
No, that's not
I don't think
him.
He falls in that. I really don't. I mean, like, I've probably disagreed with more than you have, but I don't think he falls in that category.
Yeah, he has a love of the contactees and a knowledge of the contactees that most, what I would call, believers don't have.
Yeah.
He's very Otis Carr is his guy. Like he knows more about Otis Carr than anybody I've ever run into. He's fascinated by Otis Carr, but he also has a pretty broad knowledge of the entire contactee movement, the history of it, the sociology, the subculture, that kind of stuff. The history, I think, interests him more than the actual sort of what is the phenomenon? Is there a phenomenon? But if you talk to him,
yeah, you can see Moseley coming out there.
Yes, well, exactly. I think he is actually. There's an awful lot of Jim Moseley in him. He's kind of one of Moseley's acolytes, if you will. And I think that's a good thing. But I've never actually heard him completely rule out the possibility that there might be some mystery to the paranormal. But his thing is, prove it.
Right.
I'm open-minded, but none of you, the UFO evidence, for instance, I've heard him say this a lot, is crappy. Show me the good evidence. I'm perfectly willing to look at it and have a conversation. But until you do, then you haven't made your case. And so I think that's what, you know, a lot of the sort of what really annoys him, and I don't want to speak for him, but I had him on my podcast a year or two ago. And we had a long conversation and folks can go look it up. And, you know, he kind of gets into why he's interested in it, talked a lot about the contactees. But also I think it's the kind of thing that annoys me, too. Just the believerism and even the disbelieverism, you know, just kind of people who accept on faith that this must be true when the evidence for whatever they're accepting on faith is really actually pretty lousy. And so that angers him. And so that anger comes out. But there is a genuine interest, certainly in the subculture, but I think also actually he would grudgingly admit in the possibility that there might actually be something to all of this. I think he's as interested in that as anyone else, which is the mark of an honest skeptic, somebody who keeps an open mind and says, if you can prove it, I'm willing to go on the ride with you.
Yeah, what I like about Lance is, like you said, his deep knowledge about this stuff. A lot of debunkers, they focus in on one or two little nitpicky things and just sort of ride those until everybody gets sick of them. But Lance has a real depth and breadth of knowledge about and background about these things, which makes his exchanges with some of the true believers, you know, kind of enjoyable, because you're just sort of sitting here thinking, oh God, pal, he knows more than you about this. You better just don't just stop, you know? So I agree. His comments are enjoyable.
Carlos says, tell Paul he was too young to watch Quatermass and the Pit, aka 5 million years to Earth, hence his fear of locusts. And I said, I think Paul's seen that.
No, I haven't seen it either.
Really? I've seen it.
I've got it sitting on a hard drive somewhere. I keep meaning to watch all the old Quatermass stuff, but haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah, well, this is the only one I've seen, and it's creepy. I really like it.
I hate all insects, so it's not just locusts that I hate. I hate them all, even the ones mm-hmm. who are productive, and I wish nothing but the best for, like bumblebees. I still hate them. they frighten me. They scare me. It's my phobia.
I think there's probably far more insects in Canada, especially in the spring, summer, fall, than there are ever in California.
Probably mosquitoes and black flies, though. Nothing that can kill you.
No. Oh, okay. Well, there's nothing that really in California either, I guess, not insect-wise. There's precious few scorpions in California. We have them. Snakes, yes. The poisonous snakes, like the Mojave green snake, will kill you pretty quickly. I've never even seen one. Apparently, they're aggressive, too. If you, like, mess with them, they'll chase you.
I saw one in the San Diego Zoo, speaking of Chris McBride again, and, you know, she tapped on the glass, like, poke, 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 and the thing went at the glass. It's like, and you could see the fangs come out and everything. And you know, the zoo guy or whatever went, don't poke in the glass with that one. I'm thinking, why? Could he break through the 6-inch glass or whatever? And, you know, the guy's looking at me like, just...
No, we're just tired of replacing his teeth every time he smacks into the glass.
Yeah, he seemed very aggressive. That's all I know.
They are aggressive. Yeah. Do you want to go on to the lamest paranormal story of year?
Oh, I'm sorry. You cracked up there. Did you just say what's the paranormal non-story of the year?
Lamest paranormal story of the year.
Oh, yeah. It's the Roswell slide story.
In
which
quotes.
Could have been,
Yeah,
in quotes, which could have won last year if I had done this in 2013. But that's how I had my infamous falling out over the Roswell slides with Kevin Randall in October of 2013. And the story was already about a year old then. It's now December, almost January of 2015, and the story is still going, but nothing's been revealed. Nothing's happened. It's just people arguing about things that have not been revealed. It is the longest tease that I can remember in ufology history. Even the alien autopsy got released eventually. So these guys are looking for a TV deal or whatever they're doing. They're trying to cash in. They're dragging it out. It is a non-story. It is lame. It's a non-story. It's complete bunk. And until they put up or shut up, everybody should just stop talking about it and stop feeding the kind of the mill, because it's just grinding stuff up. It's grinding people up. It's grinding space up. And it's been fun to watch people argue about it at certain times. But at some point, it reached a point for me where I just went, not even that is fun anymore. This is just, as the Smiths lyrics went, the joke isn't funny anymore. And that's the lamest non-story of the year for me by a country mile. The tweet storm doesn't even come close.
That's true, because nobody outside of, you know, like five people knew what the tweet storm was. So I agree. The Roswell slides, I honestly didn't know it had been going on for that long. Which makes it all the more pitiful. What I think it really shows is just how far along things have moved and how passé maybe Roswell has become. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, these guys would have had at least, you know, a documentary out of just suggestion that there might be slides, and now, you know, they keep trying, but nobody's biting on this. And yes, it's because there's nothing there, most likely, but there never really has to be anything there sometimes for these things to catch on. And it's sort of a sign of the times, maybe.
Well, look, there's a television show called The Curse of Oak Island, Now,
oh my gosh. Oh, I am so sick of this thing. Yeah.
For almost anyone who lives in Nova Scotia, we know that there's no curse of Oak Island. There's no treasure buried under Oak Island. And even if there was, how they tease. I watched 5 minutes of an episode tonight, and they're in Scotland, apparently, searching for Templar gold or something. I don't know what that has to do. Yes, and the whole thing.
They just can't keep wagon training all the time. They got to go start. They've kind of run that well dry, to coin a phrase or to whatever.
Literally. But Oak Island isn't very big. So if you can get a television series now out of Oak Island, and you haven't been able to make hay with these Roswell slides that, you're quite right, Aaron, 10 or 15 years ago, a network would have paid a fair amount of money and said, look, let's just put William Frakes or Mike Farrell or somebody, in front of a camera, and we'll turn that Bryant Gumbel, and we'll turn this into a big deal, like the thing where they took the metal detectors into the desert. Yep. And nothing, which leads you to believe one of two things, probably both are true, that Roswell is done, that it as a mainstream, in the public consciousness, Roswell is finished, and or some people have actually looked into this slide stuff, and even the media, even the bad entertainment media that'll put on Curse of Oak Island and Hangar One took a look at it and said, yeah, we'll pass because this is too goofy even for us.
Well, maybe not so much goofy, but maybe goofy, but also, it's one of those teases where even if they can't make enough out of it, even if there are some slides, to make it seem like it's interesting.
Curse of Oak Island. I can't stress that enough. It's just they're in their second. I know the guys who make it here. They're in their second season, I think, and they've somehow teased more than one episode out of that. So if you can tease something out of the Curse of Oak Island, you could have teased at least a 1 hour documentary out of these Roswell slides. Now look at Greer's film, The Alien Baby, Peru or Chile or whatever. He got a film made with a reasonably sizable budget out of that. James Fox is making a film based on 50-year-old files, the Project Blue Book files, most of which have been combed over by every researcher and their dog and their scorpion. There's nothing really new in there, but they're going to make a film about it. So they can make, and they are making a film about it. They can raise money. They can make films about these things. And the Roswell slides has been nothing but blog fodder for over 2 years now. So yeah, for lame non-story, boom. And prove me wrong, boys. Maybe next year it'll be the story of the year, but I somehow doubt it.
I think the story is the personalities, and the story is the fighting, and the story is the supposed – oh, the hacking, the email hacking? Wasn't there something with email hacking recently?
Yeah, last week about it.
It's – the story has – the people behind the story have become the story, and the actual slides have sort of shuffled off to the side somewhere. It's not even amusing. I can't bring myself to care about it. I think I care more about Oak Island. I really think I do. Actually, I know people who watch Oak Island, the show, religiously, because they didn't know anything about it before they saw the show. And so if you've never heard about it, it looks kind of interesting. But I mean, I read, The Cursed Templar Treasure and, books by Stephen Sora and all the pseudo history stuff back in the day. So I'm just like, yeah, I'm not doing an Oak Island show. But Roswell, yeah, I think Roswell is might be toast. Hopefully, please. But yeah, these slides, the sad sort of scary ironic thing is, what if they're real? What if they're real and just nobody cares? And the whole thing is so full of incredulity that it'll never matter.
Yeah, if you get a real quote unquote picture of a UFO, nobody's going to care.
Yep.
Same, a good analogy of what you're getting at.
But that comes back to the thing. Who said it? Was it Valet? I can never remember who said this, but they said if you actually had a real. Sort of what you thought was an alien abduction experience or an abduction experience. The last person you'd ever go talk to was a UFO researcher in abductions. And so if I found slides that had to deal that looked like aliens or whatever, that maybe came from that time period, the last people I would take them to would be Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, who have zero, especially Schmidt, credibility outside of that core group of people who worship at the Shrine of Roswell, and Anthony Bregali and all these crazy people. You wouldn't take them to them. You'd take them to real media outlets. And if there was really something to them, a real journalist would be like, yeah, I'm all over this.
Somebody actually called Nick before any of this came up and asked him what he thought that those slides like that would be worth.
Bingo. There you go.
Yep.
And the guy never talked to him again, and now Nick was part of that email hacking, which makes you think that there's, you know, and the thing is that he knew details about the slides and about what was going on that were never released, and he hadn't been told until that guy told him. And then when he got in touch with the Dream Team people, they said, how do you know that? Like, well, this guy that called me from that had a Texas accent sounded like an accent. He told me these things, you know, the things that still haven't gone public about the slides or details about them or the provenance of them or whatever. But yeah, somebody was trying to poke at Nick for to see how much the money they could get from him and maybe who they could get it from.
It all seems very 1980s, doesn't it, boys?
Very 1980s, West. except no government connection whatsoever. Just some doofus that's trying to make money.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of got a Silas P. Newton feel to me, to it. You know?
Yeah, a little bit. Otis Carr, Silas Newton, you know. Yeah.
Leo Gebauer, yes. Dr. G.
There's a really cool story that's going to come out about this that has nothing to do with flying saucers at some point.
Yeah, it'll probably make a really good film, too. Do you want to do – hey, Paul, do you want to end on a positive with the Mac Tonys Award, or do you want to end with the Paranormal Moron Award, at least in your opinion?
Let's end on a positive. Let's go to the Kerguelen Disruptor Award for biggest paranormal moron.
In the opinion of Paul Kimball and Admiral Zorgrot.
That's right. The opinions expressed in the following segment do not reflect Radio Mysterioso or Greg Bishop in any way, shape, or form.
They might, but I probably won't say anything. I have my own ideas, and they're pretty fixed on paranormal morons. Go ahead.
Right. And by I mean moron in the kindest possible way. So I say it with love and affection. So my dishonorable mentions first, because I actually get, you know, there's Stephen Bassett is always in the running, but he didn't win this year, but he gets a dishonorable mention because he's a moron. Anthony Bregaglia, who among many other things that he did this past year, threatened me with a background check after having run him on other people. I mean, it came up with his goofy Socorro explanation, pushed the Roswell slide story. I mean, he should be the winner, but he's not. And I have to give a shout out to Grant Cameron, who seems to have wandered off into new age goofy land, judging by his posts on the Facebook page for UFO updates. So Grant Cameron would be a contender as well, but they all pale in comparison to John Ventre, the MUFON guy who is on Hangar One. That should be enough to win him the award right there. But who came, among many of his other sins and transgressions, when the Malaysian Airlines flight disappeared in March of 2014, he was the guy who stepped forward and said, space aliens. So
Giorgio Tsoukalos didn't?
No, it was John Ventre. And, you know, space aliens. Now, he didn't say it was space aliens. He strongly implied that it was. But he said, we should be looking into space aliens as the probable cause. And it's at that point that it's not funny. It is funny, but it's not funny. You've got a real world tragedy going on. And this guy feels obliged to put his two cents out there. And he's not like some nut in a trailer park somewhere. This is a guy who has a platform. He has a television series. He's a MUFON, or he was, I think he still is, a MUFON state director in a relatively large state. He's got his own little cable TV show in Pennsylvania. I've seen some of it on YouTube. It's horrible. Here's a guy who's got a platform. And this is the face that ufology puts forward. And he shows up and he says, space aliens for the airlines. And I'm sure with the new airline disaster just out today in Singapore, he might come forward and say space aliens for that too. So John Ventre, hands down, the Kerguelen Disruptor Award loser, there's no other way to put it, for Paranormal Moron of the Year, for all of the things I've just stated, and so many more.
I wouldn't say moron, just because, you know, that I would call this the honestly really you're not helping award, you know, and I think,
or the delusional award.
Yes, it's like you're out there. But yeah, the Malaysian Airlines thing, because I was looking at this today. I was just sort of Googling around, and the way that places, I think CNN's iReports picked it up, because the iReports are basically this horrible, you know, crowdsourced journalism where anybody can just submit anything.
Yeah.
The headlines, you know, and the stories said MUFON director. It usually says something like MUFON director, not MUFON Pennsylvania State director, not MUFON, you know, bloviator, but MUFON director, John Ventre. And the what got me about the Malaysian Airlines thing, and this is just a peeve of mine. It isn't that he brought it, well, it is that he brought it up, but it's the weaselly word way he said, many experts are suspecting that it might be, you know, it's like, no, they aren't. One, there aren't any experts doing that. And two, if they are, they're not experts at anything. They're dumb. So it's just this sort of, you know,
the word you're looking for is moron.
I know, but
I'm sorry. But
he's a man who has said moronic things that sort of gets it out of less ad hominem, but he's a, for all we know, normal guy who has said unfortunately stupid things. But yeah,
see, I'm happy to call him a moron because I have better corporate lawyers than he does, and I have a law degree, and I'm not worried about getting sued. And frankly, all I'd have to do is walk into court and say, "Hey, here's what he said." You know, thank you. Case dismissed. Cost to Paul Kimball. So yeah,
well,
you know,
nobody's going to sue anybody because this is not like a news outlet or anything. It's an opinion show.
Plus, he's a public figure, and he's, you know, he's the other thing too. Interesting sidebar. These folks, and Ventre is certainly one of them, go around criticizing people all the time, usually government figures. Stan Friedman, for instance, is called Colonel Weaver, Richard Weaver, the guy who came up with the Roswell report, a liar multiple times, repeatedly, over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Use the word liar, which, you know, you can get sued for. They never sort of take it very well when you apply those kinds of terms to their own behavior. So I have no doubt that Ventre would be perfectly happy to call, you know, some government guy a moron, probably Barack Obama, because I think he's a right wing nut as well. You know, sort of say Barack Obama is a moron, or these government guys are lying morons, or whatever. They're liars. So, you know, good for the goose, good for the gander. When somebody steps forward and starts saying that crashed airliners or downed airliners, space aliens, when they're out there on Hangar One, oh my, if there was an award for worst television show, Hangar One, by, you know, hands down for me, is as you watch MUFON flush itself down the toilet. As anything remotely resembling a serious, credible organization,
it's deeply embarrassing. I miss MUFON. I kind of miss MUFON being irrelevant because their efforts to be hip and with it are just this is your drunk
aunt
at a
like
wedding
having
level
a,
television.
Yeah, drunk uncle at the house telling jokes that nobody likes, understands, or cares about, and it's you know, all part of my thing. Get rid of the big UFO organizations, please.
I think this show's going to do it. I think you're going to get your wish because I don't think they're going to survive this.
We could even call it the Kerguelen Disruptor Award for biggest paranormal faceplant of the year, which,
okay,
you know,
there
just like a guy who takes a step forward and boom, falls flat in his face, and then does it repeatedly. And the weird thing is, he's not actually, maybe, well, no, he is, but he's almost not the worst guy on Hangar One, because you can find, to me, the worst guy on Hangar One is, and I assume he's still doing it, but it was Richard Dolan, because there he is. And the funniest thing about Hangar One, if you've seen it, is there's Dolan sitting there on what he has to know is a terrible show, pontificating about goofy things, and he's got the chalkboard next to him with some strange equation or whatever it is that's written on it that might be a recipe for a really good bagel. I have no idea what it is. But it's just, you know, at some point people put you in situations, and I've written about this on Facebook and other places, where you can walk away. You can say, nope, I'm not going to say that. I did that when UFO Hunters took me out and wanted to interview me. Greg, you remember when I was out there? And
yes,
and,
happened to me too more than once.
Yeah, and I was brought out specifically to talk about James McDonald and the RB-47
case. Well, don't
case.
You think this is might what have happened? No, I don't think that. Well, you know, if you think about it in this way, no, not really. I was like, okay, forget it then.
Yeah, no, exactly. There I am standing in the desert, and the director's continually trying to get me to say, and I know how they work. If you say 10 seconds, even just agreeing with them slightly to get them off your back, that's the 10 seconds they'll use.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah.
So you stick to your story, and they cut me. They didn't use me in the episode, and I had no problem with that. But here's all these other guys in the paranormal world who are perfectly willing to say what people want them to say. And I have nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. James Fox was another one. If you had an option on chasing UFOs, Jim, it was to not do it or to walk away. You don't have to cash the checks. But these folks always cash the checks. They always do the shows, and they keep on keeping on. And it's because they're part of the machine. And Ventre is just another, you know, sort of a really egregious example of that. And it's one of the reasons why I left television and moved to feature films, one of many, is because I couldn't stomach it anymore. I couldn't, and I was getting more no's. I used to get commissions. Sorry for the brief rant here, but I used to get commissions to do what I considered were serious documentaries. Like them or not, I tried to take it seriously. Those dried up because people wanted to make things, you know, hey, our ratings are in things like, you know, chasing UFOs. Paul, put a vest and a gun and a flashlight or whatever and run through the desert and pretend you're doing something. And that the stuff I wanted to do just wasn't selling. So I got out. But all these other guys stayed in. And so I have nothing but criticism for them. And I'm not shy about hiding it. So Ventre, you get the Moron of the Year award, but you're only the tip of the spear. It's, you know, it's a long pointy spear, and there's a lot of blame to share around. Thus endeth my rant on that issue. I'm glad we didn't end the show on that one.
Yeah.
We've got a nice one.
Yeah. So the final one is the award winner, the 2014 Zorgi Award winner, Mac Tony's Memorial Award for Outside the Box Thinking.
Hmm. I could give that to either one of the two guys I'm on the radio with right now, because you should pick up The Chaos Conundrum by Aaron. It's a lovely book with a lot of outside the box thinking, which Nick wrote the foreword for that. Nick, it's hard to keep track of who writes forewords for who anymore.
yeah.
But, you know, Greg could win it for just hosting Radio Mysterioso and nothing else every week. But the guy I'm going to give it to is, and we're circling back to my favorite news site, is Greg Taylor, because the Daily Grail has for many years been a repository of interesting information, editorials, opinion pieces, articles, guys like Red Pill Junkie, you know, giving a voice to those folks. Greg's Dark Lore series as well, which he puts out and publishes a lot of interesting stuff. His own book, which was released in, I think, late October of 2013, what was it called? Stop Worrying. There Probably Is an Afterlife. So he's addressing, he's written extensively on the subject of near-death experiences and that kind of stuff. And always, he's not afraid, not only to not, you know, not afraid to go outside the box. He lives outside the box.
Yeah.
But he does it in a responsible, articulate, reasonable, open-minded way that shouldn't, and his criticisms of James Randi and the Randi sort of million-dollar challenge are some of the best writing I've ever heard criticizing James Randi before it became popular to do so. So Greg Taylor, I could give it to Aaron, I could give it to Nick, I could give it to Greg. They'd all be worthy recipients, but you're my guy this year for the Mac Tony's Memorial Award for Outside the Box Thinking. Keep up the good work from down under.
I think it's a good choice. I like that that not just what he's written, but with the Daily Grail, he sort of has provided – you mentioned Red Pill Junkie, who if anybody hasn't out there listened to the interviews he's done on Radio Mysterioso, you should, because they're really good. But writers like Red Pill Junkie and others, he's given them a platform. And it's and that's one of the things that significant people do, is that they don't just push their own stuff. They provide, you know, a launching point for, you know, a wide variety of other thinkers and other people who are doing things. So I think Greg Taylor is a good choice.
You know why I like Greg Taylor is all the reasons you said. And the other thing is he does something that probably pisses off skeptics, believers, people on all sides of the issue. He actually delves into the occult side of the UFO phenomenon and the paranormal.
Yes.
And nobody wants to touch that. Nobody really wants to touch it. One, because it just makes them sound crazy, as, you know, just by association. Well, they're Satanists or whatever. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how do people relate to each other? How do they relate to the way they think about things? How do they relate to the external world? And how does that go through your brain and become whatever it becomes, that reality in your brain? That is all addressed by a lot of, especially, which is what he's talking about, Western occultism. That's the part of the Western occultism people don't talk about, don't think about, and don't really understand, is the self-examination part. What goes on in your head, and what do your desires cause, and what can you do with your desires, and what can you cause your desires to manifest? That's really important with the paranormal and the UFO thing, I think. It has been for a long time, and he's one of the few people that champions that, Greg Taylor. So that's my props to him.
Yes, he's the second best thing to ever come out of New Zealand after Split Ends. So
oh jeez.
And not the Lord of the Rings movies, I guess.
Well, yeah, maybe the original thinking too was, yeah,
they were just filmed there. They didn't, you know, Peter Jackson's not a New Zealander, so
I thought he was. Besides,
he took The Hobbit and he turned it into three mind-numbingly terrible movies that just thud you over the head.
I thought he was from New Zealand. One of his first films was done in New Zealand about a New Zealand story. Those two girls that murdered one of their mothers.
Heavenly Creatures, yeah,
yes.
I quite like it.
Yes.
Maybe he is. Hold on, I might have misspoken. I'm
Wikipedia
Googling him.
Wikipedia calls him a New Zealand film director.
Okay, well, there he is. He's from New Zealand. I take it back. I'm terribly sorry. That would
Yes, and his knighthoods do have the NZ in them.
That's true.
Oh, well.
Yep.
You were faster on the trigger than I was.
It's those crack research skills finally coming in handy.
Wikipedia.
That's right.
So, yeah, I take it back. So Greg is the third best thing to ever come out of New Zealand, because even though he's made the three horrible Hobbit films, you can't take away the original Lord of the Rings from him. So plus Heavenly Creatures, lovely. Although he did make the King Kong remake.
I guess you want your heroes to be perfect every time. That doesn't really happen, except if it's Kubrick or maybe even the Coen brothers. I'm not sure.
He did produce District 9, so that's a big thumbs up.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. So so there you go. Those are the Zorgi Awards, and one, I guess you could call the Kerguelen Disruptor non-award for Biggest Moron. So there they are, the 2014 awards. I'm sure everybody will disagree with everything I just said, but that's fine.
I don't disagree with everything you said. In fact, I agreed with most of it.
No, I didn't mean you. I meant the hoi polloi.
Ah, yes.
I just like using the word hoi polloi.
Radio hoi polloi, I think it should be called.
The hoi polloi.
Yeah. That's a great, I really love that word.
Somebody just posted, Shepard Johnson just posted in a group that I can't name on Facebook because it's private, but it's where we cabal type people hang out. We're all members. he posted the picture for the John Ventry Award, and he put, John, quotation marks, Obama is the Antichrist, end quotation marks, Ventry. So
he really said he's really one of those Antichrist birther people.
Oh, he hates Obama. Yeah. He's you know, far right. But, you know, the weird thing is he shares that with a lot of people now in a disturbing way to me in the UFO community. A lot of them are seems to be a right wing. And it's not because I don't like right wingers, which I generally don't.
Paul, there kind of always has been, actually, from the. Oh, but you know what? It's been the fringy, wacky part of the, you know, really wacky part of the UFO thing that have been that way. And now it's more kind of mainstream.
Because it's coalescing with a lot of the conspiracy-oriented stuff, and it's also coalescing with a lot of the anti-Obama stuff, which some of which I think is rooted in racism. But it's a very weird, and I think it's a bit of a toxic mix that, you know, ufology, whatever ufology is, would be well served to stay away from.
Yeah, I think ufology would be well served to stay away from ufology, actually.
Yeah.
That's probably. You know, I don't want to be a member of any club that would let me in. Well, ufology will let anybody in.
It really is toxic to children and animals and all other things that should be protected. We need to stay away from ufology. It's frightening.
Next time I'm at the county fair or a rodeo or something, they have those guys that make those little planks. They wood burn the planks and then they, you know, They laminate them for you or whatever, so you can have, like, you know, the Johnsons or something like that goes out in front of your house, or, you know, kiss the cook or whatever. I'll put one that just says, maybe not even my name, but just says ufology here or ufologist, and just hang that outside the door somewhere.
I did notice that, is it Hudgens, the guy who runs MUFON or one of the big MUFON muckety mucks? I did notice on Facebook his occupation is listed as worked at ufologist. And I just, like, how do you even do that with a straight face? It's like, what do you do? Where have you worked? I'm a ufologist. I mean, that's what unemployed guys say. You know,
there's only one person that can make that claim. And that's Stan Friedman. Because he really and even he goes out of his way to say, you know, I continued working, and he did, for many years in Canada as a nuclear physicist on consulting projects and stuff. Point Le Preux in New Brunswick, which is a nuclear power plant, and sea to radiation, yeah, and everything else. Nobody knows him for that, though. He can say, I made money, I made a lot of my living being a ufologist. He's it.
Yeah. Yep. Maybe Linda Howe.
Maybe Linda Howe, although she does so many other things that are not related to UFOs, it's hard to differentiate. I was going to say maybe Nick Pope, but Nick Pope does so much media work now. A little bit of it is UFO related, and a lot of it isn't.
Yeah,
Stan Friedman never got into cryptozoology, never got into anything else. He was a ufologist. That was his thing.
Yes.
And I think he's the only guy that I can think of that should be able to claim that title now that Jim Moseley is dead, because Jim Moseley could have claimed it too.
For the most part, honestly, you make more money selling your blood plasma than being a ufologist. Yeah. I mean, it's not really an occupation, but yeah, he's worked at ufologist. It's like, that's grammatically, it's bad. You know, the way Facebook puts this, is that irked me. He lost a lot of my respect there. His mustache cost him the rest of it. But, you know, it's just, there's just
that and chicks, if you like New Age cougars.
I hope he's married.
Oh.
He would be a tough sell on Plenty of Fish if they, you know, he had to sit
down. No, I meant the money thing, because I remember having an argument online with UFO Mystic. It's somebody said, I think he was just trying to cause shit. He said, oh, well, you know, all these people are just into it, so that for all the girls and money. And a bunch of us came on and said, what? Which conventions and things are you going to? I'd like to find out all the girls and money that come from, you know, even writing one book or, you know, going to one lecture or 10. That's what I said. I think you get New Age cougars and, like, you know, $500 if you're lucky.
I'll agree with the money part, with the exception of a few people, maybe like Stan, who have. But he's worked very hard at it, too. So that's not a criticism. He traveled, you know, watch my film.
Yeah, it looks, you watch his film, it's like you do not envy Stan Friedman.
No, it was a lonely, lonely sort of life on the road, which he enjoyed. So that, fair enough. But I will disagree a bit on the picking up women thing, because I've been to enough conferences and I've been to enough, you know, hanging out with the speakers afterwards. And I have seen I know it sounds terrible. In wrestling, they call them ring rats. but, you know, in rock and roll, they call them groupies. I saw them when I was a musician, too. And ufology has them. And I've seen them with some ufologists that you would be shocked if I was to tell you who these people were. and you know, that does kind of go on. It's the seedier side of the UFO subculture. And some of the ufologists that have been involved in that kind of stuff, I happen to know, you know, were married at the time. So no names, nothing like that. But it is out there. So I would disagree a little about the finding women part, although you only within the UFO subculture. It's not something you could ever take to a bar, you know, downtown and go, I'm a ufologist.
I'd really enjoy watching somebody try that, to pick up women at an actual place where there's humans.
There we go. Yeah, there's a TV show. Screw all this, Hangar One stuff.
I would watch the hell out of a TLC series based around a ufologist in a basement trying to pick up women with that.
I was
That sounded terrible for a second there, but I understood it. Are you still there, Aaron?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to do a show. I pitched a show once about Greg. You might remember this 7 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, and it was going to be Mac, Greg, Nick, and I in a camper van. It's kind of based on Three Men Seeking Monsters, and we'd start in Oregon whichever state is furthest in the Northwest, Washington, Oregon. I think it's Washington.
Washington.
And we'd hit all 48 continental states on a magical mystery tour of everything that was weird. And then at the end, we'd show up in Key West, Florida, where we'd go to the Holy Grail, which was Jim Moseley. And we'd all, you know, he'd be like the shrine, the Buddha, the whatever. And I could never convince anyone to buy it. I actually pitched it. And they were like, well, what's the point? I said, it's like Seinfeld. There is no point. We'll just be funny. And nobody.
That would've been awesome. Oh,
I was
man.
6 years too early. I might actually be able to get that sold now. But unfortunately, you know, it wouldn't be any fun without Max. So so it'll never get done. But yeah, that would have been that would have been awesome.
Oof. Yeah.
Oh, well, folks can imagine it. Now, here's my last question for you guys. What do you think is going to be the big thing in 2015? I'll tell you what mine is, and then I actually think Rendlesham is in the process of blowing up now, and I think 2015 it's going to be the story. It might be the lamest story by the end of next year, but it's going to be the biggest UFO story, in the sense that you have Peter Robbins attacking Nick Pope, John Burroughs attacking Jim Peniston, Charles Halt involved with Larry Warren. It's really becoming, as they used to say, it's Britain's Roswell, and in none of the good ways. And it's all blowing up on the 30th. It's the 35th anniversary is coming up next year.
Yeah.
And it's the pettiness, the jealousy that I think's driving it, the ambition, the greed and everything else, the egos. You're really seeing ufology at its worst in a microcosm with this. And if Nick Pope decides to stop ignoring it, because he has stayed above the fray, and actually gets involved, which he may or may not, I don't know, that's when it'll really blow up. But that it's been weird and fun to listen to Robbins on the radio and some of the back and forth with Halt and Warren and stuff. And it's a train wreck in progress. Started late this year. It's going to continue through 2015. If you're interested in the subculture, that's the story for me right now.
Aaron?
Yeah, gosh, I got to say, I've got to agree about Rendlesham. I hadn't been paying much attention to it. And then I start seeing these little messages and blog posts and comments and people taking sides and things getting really, really nasty over this case that honestly I'd half forgotten about. But I don't see anything else on the horizon that could eclipse it, unless the Roswell slides turn out to be either something really interesting or something borderline felonious and criminal. So unless something happens with the Roswell slides, I think the Rendlesham thing has some potential.
Yeah, I would agree with both of you. And I'm at this weird place where it's, and I've talked about it before, it's starting to get really hard for me to really care about any of this stuff, except the kind of thing we talked about, which I'm so happy that Paul brought up about Greg Taylor and that core thing. That is like this little glimmer of hope that makes me very happy and like pulls me back into it. Plus talking to people like you and Nick and Red Pill and Go Rightly and everybody that we have on here. I think if I had to take a guess about what story would be the biggest story like this next year or some year coming up, it would be a hoax that goes on for a really long time that's done really well.
Yeah, I could see that.
Intentional hoax that is brought up. Because you know what's interesting? The Roswell slides hooked themselves on to something that had to do with, a very famous case. And every time you see there was another thing that had legs for a little while, but it was based on another famous case that a lot of people knew about. And so people would say, oh, yeah, that case. Roswell's the easy one to do. Maybe somebody will come up with something, new information about the, Pascagoula abduction or something like that. And like, here's a picture somebody took from, down the river across the river there in Pascagoula or something like that. If that can take off for a little while, that would be a big story. And it might escape ufology for a little while, for the UFO elite or at least the hobbyists and people are interested in it for a while. I think that would be a big story and very likely to happen. And I don't know, what it would involve or what case it would be or how it would be put together, but you know, some enterprising person that knew what they were doing, kind of like this Sony, you know, hacking thing.
Yeah.
Somebody that can do something on that level, that would be pretty amazing, and it would take over for a while, and I don't know if it would be a bad thing, actually. It would actually probably be pretty entertaining for a while.
It probably would be, and if I can just not amend my judgment, one thing that I was just reminded of because I saw it out of the corner of my eye on a screen here is Kurt Collins put up a really good post yesterday about sort of where do we go with Cash Landrum after this. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't it be awesome if he mentions that the helicopter people who might have been involved are retirement age and might be able legally to talk without fear of too much horrible stuff happening to them. So if we could get some movement or some talking about that, or if new files come out that MUFON might have somewhere, if those files come out in a way that isn't an episode of Hangar One, which would, I think, that'd be bad. I think I'm waiting for the next thing about Hangar One is when something ends up on Hangar One, does that ruin it for real investigation, or at least damage it in some way because of the way the show is?
Yeah, well, so it damages it, like don't touch it for a year or so and then quietly start doing what you were going to do.
Yeah, it would sort of put a pause to things. But given that we're coming up on an anniversary, 35 years for Cash Landrum, I would like to see more on that, because that's a fascinating case. And again, Radio Public, if you haven't heard the Radio Mysterioso interview with Kurt Collins, you should go listen to that.
Yes.
There's some, he's done some really good stuff. His Blue Blurry Lines website is engrossing.
Yeah, he scared me at first. It's like, what kind of, is he a skeptical kind of debunkerish person? A fundamental skeptic type person. It's like, he's not at all.
No.
He's sincerely interested in the stuff and sincerely wants to get to the bottom of Cash Landrum. And he's just taking it, as far as I can tell, just taking it upon himself to take the story where the information leads him.
Yeah.
Which is rare.
Yeah. Yeah,
yes, I mean, and he's an honest, honest guy. He's open-minded. He's skeptical, and he's got a good sense of humor too. He can on some private Facebook pages, he, as much as any of us, pokes fun at some of these people.
Yeah,
but you know, he's very committed to the Cash Landrum case and to doing real research there. He's, you know, that's the kind of guy you need if, for good or ill, in terms of whether you think whatever the answer is about UFOs, whether they're aliens or not aliens or whatever, at least he's trying to get at the truth of one particular case, especially that case. And he's done a pretty darn good job of it, too.
Yeah.
What I like about how he's approached this is the acknowledgement that there was this incident in 1980 that almost immediately got buried in all of this almost pop culture, pop UFO detritus of 1980s ufology. That you know, sort of obscured a lot of the facts and added quote facts that everybody knows about Cash Landrum. And it's because I remember the first mention of it I saw was actually in one of these John Lear, Bill Cooper documents, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So which it had nothing really to do with. It just sort of got absorbed into this. So yeah. I think his approach of, you know, let's get back to basics and back to the original witnesses and strip away all of this dead tissue is a good one.
Yeah.
By the way, I forgot one thing. Do I have 2 minutes, Greg?
We are 15 minutes over and there's no other show, so you take what time you need.
There's one other thing, too. It's the Zorgi Hall of Fame and Hall of Shame. I completely forgot. I have them written in front of me. Previous members of the Hall of Fame include Mac Tonies, Dick Hall, Jim Moseley, Jerry Clark. Members of the Hall of Shame include Silas Newton, Alfred Weber, Linda Moulton Howe. This year's inductees, wow, it's like tacking it on. It's the WWE Hall of Fame. In the Hall of Fame, I'm inducting Errol Brewsnap, longtime radio host of Strange Days Indeed and runner of UFO Updates. I'm inducting Jim and Coral Lorenzen, the founders and longtime purveyors, if you will, of APRO, one of the great UFO research organizations of the 50s and 60s. And I'm inducting Nick Redfern because he's been around for so long, and anyone who's written that many books deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. In the Hall of Shame, I'm inducting Steve Bassett because he belongs. He has to be there. If Greer is there, Bassett has to be there. I'm inducting Bob Lazar. I don't care if anybody thinks that he's telling the truth. He's not. Bob Lazar deserves to be in the Hall of Shame. And I'm inducting John Lear. Because, well, if you... There's now. There's nothing inherently wrong. It doesn't mean
no.
That
not John Lear. Is Bill Cooper in there already?
No, you didn't let me finish.
Well, that's a shame then.
I have two other inductees.
Oh,
one
geez,
of which
you're going
is
nuts.
Wild Bill Cooper going right into the Hall of Fame as well, and last but not least, going into both the Halls of Fame and the Hall of Shame, William Moore. He deserves to be in the Hall of Shame for the Paul Benowitz mess, but I think he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame not only for his work in Roswell, but also for that one legendary MUFON speech where he basically said everything that ever needed to be said about ufology, past, present, and future. That's kind of like Hogan beating Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 1. That is a turning point in ufology. Most people think for ill. I think for good. I think that speech was a classic. So Moore goes in both halls. He is the only man to be in both halls, which is quite an achievement.
Your hall.
I think Moore's speech is really more of a Hogan joining the NWO moment.
Well, that could be too.
Yeah, it was sort of a massive heel turn. You know, it was just we just alienated everybody but Alex Sarmiento out there with our wrestling talk. But
and Tony Morrill maybe.
And Tony Morrill.
You only half alienated me, so. Bill, at this point, could not possibly care less about any of this stuff.
Oh, so. I know. And that doesn't bother me. I don't care. At some point, you don't care whether somebody cares. They become figures for history to be discussed. So it doesn't matter. You know, Bill Moore could drop off the face of the earth literally today, and it doesn't matter. It's what he did in the past. He's a public figure, and people can debate whether he did was right or whether what he did was wrong.
Which we have done on this show.
Many times. And, you know, I've come to the point of view in Moore's case, he's one of those Shakespearean figures in a penny ante small pool like ufology. But within that, he's kind of got a Shakespearean tinge about him. You know, he did some good things. He did some bad things. And he's a morally conflicted character. So it's the kind of thing screenwriters love, guys like Moore, because they're not bad, but they're not good. They're interesting.
Yes.
And that's,
you know, what's funny is not because not for the same reasons, but Bill would probably agree with you.
Yes.
He's not bad, but he's not good. And you know what? And as he says that, his middle finger goes up.
Yeah. So he's cool. He's, you know, he's one of the very few guys who was ever cool in ufology. And that's kind of a good thing, too. You know, he just didn't give a rat's ass what people thought of him. There's something to be said for that. I actually respect and admire that because I sort of have the same opinion. So,
and if you were on somebody else's show, you would be saying how much of a horrible person he was and he should be, you know, whatever.
No, that's what Don Ecker said. Don Ecker, when we were on the show, even went a lot further than I did. I think he said he should be shot or something. I mean, he wanted Bill Moore, like, taken out. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? You're making me like Bill Moore more and more with each word out of your mouth, Don, because you're going too far. The guy did, and his speech, you know, and at the Vegas MUFON thing, which you were there for, Greg.
Yes.
It's one of those defining moments of ufology for me. And everyone who knows about that speech would say the same thing. Yeah. Stan still talks about it. Stan still remembers that speech like it was yesterday. And it was what, 25 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. Frightening. I was a frightened little boy watching that speech. Also excited. It was one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
I would imagine
just the emotion, the raw emotion going on during that thing it's probably the best live thing I've ever seen as a performance. I got to go outside and have everybody like unload that on me because I was sitting there selling copies of the speech. What the fuck are you doing? It's like, I don't know what he does. I'm just selling it. If you want it, fine. If not, go away.
Sort of going off of what Paul said about Bill Moore, I think that one of the things, just from what I've read and when I hear him on even going back to the 80s on the Open Mind with Bill Jenkins show when he'd be on there talking about, because those are all up on archive.org, he just comes across as a guy who was who was given the opportunity to make a lot of very momentous decisions about what he should do at various points when people presented him these things he could say or do in the whole UFO context, and he made a decision and ran with it. And you don't see him 30 years later defending himself. You don't see him wringing his hands about what he should or shouldn't have done. He's just like, hell, that's what I did. So take it or leave it. Yeah. And there's hardly none of that in this field. And I always found it very refreshing.
You know who he reminds me of? Here it is. A music example, because so many bands break up and then they get back together. I mean, even the Eagles got back together. The Hell Freezes Over tour. The band that never got back together, and I'm pretty sure never will, the Smiths. Because Johnny Marr and Morrissey fell out so badly that, you know, it's like never going to happen, even though the fans scream for it. They want the Smiths to come back. They want them to do a show again. The Smiths refuse. And Moore is like that. A lot of people would like him to come back and answer questions. Almost any radio host would love to have him on their show and ask him questions.
Yeah.
Greg, as you know, I got an email from Stan Friedman a week ago asking me for Bill's, you know, to ask you for Bill's contact information because Stan wanted to get in touch with him. And, you know, people still want to talk about and to Bill Moore. And Bill Moore's like the Smiths. Screw it. It was 1980. I'm done. You people can keep talking. I've moved on. And he's never coming back. And that, you know, it's like, great. That is the perfect poetic ending. I can't think of anybody else in ufology that's ever done that. Walked away and stayed away. They all come back eventually.
Yeah. Which is why you and I, and I think some few people we know, are never going to say, that's it, I quit.
I've said that, but here I am.
Oh, you said that? See, back. You made the mistake too.
Yeah.
I will never say that. I could think it. Up. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I closed my blog down, 2 years ago or whatever, but I didn't delete it. I put it, you know, in abeyance, but it was still there. I could reactivate it. If I really wanted to walk away, I would have just deleted the blog so that I could never recover it, but I didn't. And then I turned it back on, you know, a year later. So I came back in a different way, and I don't do it as often and all that, but Moore never came back. He's never, you know, stayed away. You got to respect that. That's like, Shane leaving, or the, you know, Eastwood riding off at the end of Pale Rider, and I'm never coming back, folks. So that just enhances his legend. It's kind of awesome.
It is almost 10:30. Anybody else that you want to put in one hall or the other, or say something about either of you?
I agree. I think. We can't do any better than putting Bill Moore in both halls. I think that sort of sums up a lot of the, I don't know if I want to say the wonder of ufology in the 80s, but the wide-eyed wonder, the wide-eyed horrible wonderfulness of my era, the 80s and 90s. You know, it's weird. I have nostalgia for that era, and I have nostalgia for reading old, you know, BBS text files about people's reaction to the Bill Moore speech and stuff like that. I just find it fascinating. So I kudos to Bill Moore being everywhere he can be.
Yeah, it's interesting. The 80s were a decade like that, weren't they? I mean, Bruce Springsteen can release a song about disenfranchised Vietnam veterans called Born in the USA, but he does it in a really sort of hard rockin' cool, you know, manner. And the Republican Party takes it and turns it into an anthem for the Republican Party. And that's kind of what the 80s was. It was a confused decade where, you know, even when you were trying to do something really, because I've heard Springsteen's original acoustic version and you'd never mistake it for a pro USA anthem. But that's what the 80s did to people. Yeah. Everything about the 80s was conflicted. And Bill Moore is probably the apotheosis of that when it comes to ufology. The good, the bad, the ugly, he kind of represents all of it. So he's in a weird way. He's kind of the poster child, isn't he, for the 80s? Because he was there for all of it. Roswell, MJ-12, Benowitz, everything.
He wasn't there for Roswell. He started it.
Well, yes.
Him and Stan and Charles
Berlitz. But then other
Berlitz.
People, you know, took it up. So he continued to be with it. But he was there for all of it. And then when the 80s ended, he left.
Yep. 89. Yeah.
And it's almost like Poison. Would Poison, the band, have been as if they continued playing into the 90s, well, they just wouldn't have worked out. I mean, some bands, it's like the Beatles at the end of the 60s. It's the right time to leave because, you know, this get out while the getting's good. I don't think Bill Moore would have done as well in the 90s or the aughts or whatever. He was there. That was the right decade for him. It was a confusing time.
Yeah. The 80s were about, whether you're talking about Bill Moore or about Bruce Springsteen, the 80s were very much about creating marketable narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And the 90s were about deconstructing those narratives and remixing them. And and so, you know, it was, you know, it's a different sort of thing. In the 90s, we had the sort of hideous, deformed stepchildren of Bill Moore running around. And not literally, but...
That's the most intelligent thing I've ever heard said on a paranormal related radio show ever.
Well, thank you.
The 90s were about deconstructing them. Oh my God, I wish I'd said that. I'm not kidding. That was gold.
Yes.
Oh, well, thanks.
You've nailed it. That's what the 80s and 90s were.
I'm going to drop the mic, you know, just get out.
what's your rap hear nickname just... again?
G-Money.
G-Money. There you go. It's a very 80s nickname.
G-Money out.
G-Money out.
G-Money out. There you go.
Okay, well, we will end on that wonderful positive note. And well, the epochal statement that Aaron made. You're right. I agree with you, Paul.
I've posted all the as we've been going. I've been live posting the award plaques on the Radio Mysterioso Facebook page.
I've seen.
So I'll put them up on my blog. And to the winners who I actually speak to, I'm pretty sure John Ventre. We'll have to find his on his own. You know, I'll send copies. So feel free, folks, if you're listening, Greg Taylor, anybody, Nick, post them on your website, your official Zorgi Award winners for 2014. And you all deserved it. Y'all, fine job.
Well, thank you. And thanks, Aaron and Paul, both. And Paul, for coming up with this. When I never have an idea for the show except for just BSing, this provided a nice framework for us to talk about a lot of stuff. So thanks.
All right. Oh. Thank you for having me.
Paul always gets to choose the song going out, so I will ask Aaron this time. Is that all right? If I've got it.
Okay. Zorgra concurs. That's fine.
Okay. And if I don't, I'll just look on YouTube.
Okay. Let's see. Ooh, wow. Choice of
the
song.
Pressure,
okay.
The pressure.
It is the pressure. There was one that I heard you play one time. It was a 50s UFO thing. It was... by the Buchanan Brothers, I want
to
say.
Better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers.
Yes, that's the one. I play that in class sometimes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I actually had 20 minutes on Heaven's Gate and Hail Bop and Art Bell this last semester. So, yeah, that's
coolest
that's,
history professor in America.
Yeah, right there. Yeah. I would. There was no argument from me about that. Do you know the Buchanan Brothers had another song about atomic power, which uses the exact same chords?
Yes, because that one it's in the background of one of the scenes of Atomic Cafe.
Yeah, there's a power greater than atomic. That's it.
Yeah, and so when I'd seen that for years, and then when I heard the UFO one on your show, I was like. I think that's the same tune. At first, I was being generous. That's a similar chord progression. No, it's just the same song. So,
It's basically the same song. But and when I hear it, I start singing the flying saucer music, and then the other way around when I hear flying, because I just want to see how long I can go singing the different, you know, the completely different but exactly same music lyrics.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Shepard Johnson has just posted this on the radio, or no, I think it's on, yes, my Facebook page. There's been no sirens in this episode.
No, there haven't.
Wondering.
There have not been one set of sirens. You know why? Because like Patton Oswalt said, he loves L.A. between Christmas and New Year's because everybody leaves.
Ah.
This is the first time that's ever happened for me. Yeah, it's like I Am Legend, but you can get a sandwich. So.
All right, that's funny. Oh well, now I've done it all. I'll never be on the show again because no sirens.
Dub them in. I did not hear any coming by because if we did, if I heard some coming by, I would have stuck the microphone out the window right in the middle of whoever was saying.
Well, it's even weirder because I live on Ambulance Alley. The road path. If it's not you, you'd hear it from here because there hasn't been a single ambulance go by in the 2.5 hours I've been on the show, which is unheard of.
No ambulances, no fire trucks, no police cars. That's what's always going by here, sometimes, usually multiple times. Not once today.
It's like Night of the Comet. While we've been doing this, you know, the world has stopped.
I can't believe that you know about that movie.
There's an 80s reference for you.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul and Aaron, for being on the show, and a fun show and a good discussion, and you made me laugh a lot, which is always a good show.
Super. Thanks, guys. Real
pleasure. Thank you. Good to talk to you guys.
All right. Talk to you soon. Talk to both of you soon.
Okay.
Adios.
Here's Los Buchanan Brothers. You hear it?
Yeah. You better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. It may be the coming of the judgment day. It's a sign, there's no doubt, of the trouble that's about. So I say, my friends, you'd better start to pray. With better men our way, you better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. It may be the coming of the judgment day.
You know, as a special bonus, I think I'm going to play Power Greater Than Atomic, and then I will sign off. Still there? Oh, there we go. I didn't have the volume up. Anyway, yeah, Power Greater Than Atomic, and then we will see you soon, talk to you both soon, and thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Good night, guys.
Bye. All right. Good night.
Same song.
Man may talk about his power and his will to have his way, how he can take the lives of men and rule them all someday. There's one thing he's forgetting in the great plan he does make, that God gives to him everything and everything can take. There's a power greater than
see those high and saucers,
the power of the one that
the judgment
on
day
high. If he's trying,
there's no doubt that the trouble that's about.
Power,
so you
some, but
something,
must
something.
Every rock within
steel.
The mountains will melt at his command. So when you're panning power that will sweep away the sod, don't forget there is no power to equal that of God. There's a power greater than atomic. It's the power of the one that sits on high. If he strikes us with his mighty power, not just some, but everyone must die.
Oh.
Sirens!
There you go, there was a siren.
Yay!
island of Bikini. Great men came and plans were laid to prove to all the people what power he had made. But after it was over, even through the blinding steam, the sea and sky and change it proved that God is still supreme. There's a power.